Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is the perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through.
And thank you once again for coming to Bard's Logic Political Talk, part of the growing conservative conversation and also part of the Patriot Journalist Network. And you can find more of the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. Also, please go to the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. Check out our featured guest page where you can have see a list of all the folks we've had onto the show. And also we have other pages such as our Give page, which has some wonderful organizations that could use your help, and I appreciate it, and I'm sure they would as well. And of course also please check out our sponsors and affiliates page, because the more you help out those folks, of course, the more it helps out Bard's Logic Political Talk, and the more we'll be able to be on the air. And, of course, we have there our Go Sun Stove Solar Cooking, which you can travel anywhere with the Go Sun Stove, the solar oven, in which you can cook a meal in 20 minutes just using the power of the sun. Of course, you can go either camping or hiking or on the beach, or, of course, in Washington, D.C. for Operation American Spring. And so on the website, we have a video showing you more about it, as well as a video showing the Green Cycler, which is a home composter. So check that out as well. So please check out our affiliates, and we'd really appreciate it. So, of course, tonight, join our guest gubernatorial candidate Ken Krawchuk, conservative activist Cindy Todd, founder of Overpasses for America James Neighbors, our constitutional scholar Kelly Mordecai, and our contributor Dan Gregg, who is an activist and former columnist for the Washington Times. So call in later and join our roundtable discussion, because as you know, once a caller calls in, then as long as they are respectful, they are able to remain on the show. And this said, Bard's Logic does welcome Pennsylvania gubernatorial candidate Ken Krawchuk to discuss separation of society and state, which is different than the separation of church and state debate. This goes outside of religion to the government remaining outside of its citizens' personal decisions. Some of the topics we will discuss tonight are abortion, the legalization of drugs, the LGBT issues, prostitution, the environment, the Constitution, and more. We will debate on whether the state, both federal, and this is during the discussion portion, we'll debate on whether the state, both federal and state governments, ought to stay out of the choices made by individuals. Questions will be asked on, are some government oversights needed for the good of society and other individual liberties? So please call in later at 347-945-7428 to tell us what you, the listener, think. And a little bit about our guest, Mr. Krawchuk is the founder and president of Ken Krawchuk & Associates, a 25-year-old information technology consulting firm, and has been a professional computer programmer since 1970. He currently serves as a business architect for the pharmaceutical, insurance, and financial markets. Mr. Krawchuk is a freelance writer and author of Atlas Snubbed, a dystopic parody sequel to Ayn Rand's Atlas Shrugged. He has also served as a guest columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer newspaper. Mr. Krawchuk is a professional public speaker, and he regularly competes in contests, speech contests, having won finals at the District 38 Human Speech Contest, Evaluation Contest, and Impromptu Speaking Contest. He's also served four terms as District 38 Parliamentarian. And, of course, tonight we are on Bard's Logic, which is the grassroots We the People show. And without any further ado, we will bring in our guest. Thank you very much, Ken, for calling to the show. How are you?
I'm doing great, Robert. Thanks for inviting me here tonight.
Great, and thanks for coming on. I tell you what, I did some research, of course, while getting the questions together for tonight, and I'm definitely looking to our interview this evening. And so what I'll start off with is I asked this of all the candidates that we've had on, and we've actually had, and we'll bring this up again, is you were the third candidate we have on from Pennsylvania, and actually for governor of Pennsylvania. We had someone from the Green Party and also, I believe, an independent as well. So tell us what motivated you to enter the race, and why did you choose to run for the Libertarian Party?
Well, let me take those one at a time. First of all,
sure.
The reason why I got involved in the race is because government in Pennsylvania is just too large, too intrusive, and far too expensive. Do you know that over the last 50 years, the cost of government in Pennsylvania has been rising at more than three times the rate of inflation? It doesn't matter if it's a Democrat in office, doesn't matter if it's a Republican in office, doesn't matter if it's the high inflation of the Carter years or low inflation, good times or bad, more than three times the rate of inflation. Well, that's one of the big reasons why I chose to run for governor, because when I'm governor, that trend will end. Using the power of the veto, I'm promising that I can hold the line on the growth of government by vetoing every single tax increase. And better yet, I can reduce the size of government by using the line item veto to get rid of pork barrel spending, unconstitutional programs, things like that. And these are things that I can do on my own. They're powers granted by the Constitution, so I don't need the help of the courts or the legislature or anyone like that. So I see a Pennsylvania where we have less taxes, less expensive government, and that will improve the economy and improve jobs. Now, that's half your question. The other half is, why would I choose to run as a libertarian? Well, that's because we libertarians are different from the two old parties, because we are the party of principle. Every law we support, every law we oppose, can be traced back to one central idea, the idea that your life is yours, that your property is yours, that you have the inalienable right to live your life your way without interference, provided only that you respect the rights and property of others. That's it. That's what it means to be a libertarian. Your life, your way, as long as you respect others. So that's why I'm a libertarian, because that's the golden rule. And what more law do we need than the golden rule for Pennsylvania? I could say a lot more, but let me take a breath here and let me give you a chance to get a few words in.
We'll move on. And as I mentioned earlier, is that it's a pretty saturated race there for governor. So why specifically choose that position to run for?
Well, because that's the one that could have the greatest impact, and from a number of directions. Well, first of all, I already mentioned about how I can hold the line on taxes and improve the economy of Pennsylvania. There's also several other things that the governor can do unilaterally. For example, take crime. There's something that the governor can do, which I'm surprised nobody has done before. The Commonwealth in Pennsylvania, in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, did a study and found that 95% of all crimes are committed by only 5% of the criminals. So what I'm planning to do, I can be guaranteed to reduce crime by using the power of parole. Specifically, I'm going to eliminate parole for violent criminals. I think it's insane to let these guys out of jail, especially after we finally get them in through our convoluted criminal justice system. And since 95% of crimes are committed by 5% of the criminals, we're guaranteed to reduce crime. And again, this is a power granted by the Constitution to the governor so that I have that. Again, I don't need the permission of the courts. I don't need the permission, the cooperation of the legislature. I can reduce crime unilaterally. And there are so many other powers granted to the governor that can be used to improve Pennsylvania, not only the economy, but also our quality of life. Reducing crime is one. Now, a lot of times when I talk about reducing crime, people say, oh, Ken, what are you going to do? Build more prisons? How are you going to keep all these people in jail? Well, the short answer is that there are a lot of people in jail right now who don't belong there. And I'm talking specifically about pot smokers. Nobody thinks a pot smoker should belong in prison. And again, the Constitution gives the governor the power over the pardon. And what I'm promising to do is my first day in office, I will start the ball rolling to pardon every single nonviolent drug offender. Now, of course, if they robbed somebody or dealt drugs to kids or something like that, they'll stay safely in prison. But if they were just kicking back, smoking a joint, watching The Simpsons, they have a get-out-of-jail-free card from this governor. And again,
I definitely agree with you on that point.
Everybody agrees with me on that point. You know, I ran for governor in 2002, and I was saying those exact same stands back then. But in 2002, they were cutting edge when I was talking about decriminalizing marijuana, pardoning nonviolent drug offenders. Today, it's common wisdom. It's true in Colorado and Washington State. What are there, 19 states now that have decriminalized medical marijuana? Back then, we were the party of the future. Today, we're still the party of the future. And there are some other cutting-edge things which are, I'll be talking about later on tonight, hopefully. So it's not,
oh, yeah,
not just a few things.
There's one that, yeah, there's one particular issue that I was reading, and I was very impressed, and we'll bring that up later on. But definitely, I'm actually looking forward to all the conversation with a couple of them in particular. But tonight we are focusing on the we'll have more on this on the roundtable discussion tonight, depending on how long it could stay. But, of course, we'll be doing this with our panelists and our audience. But the concept focusing on the concept of separation of society and state. And please tell us what your perspective of this concept is and how it differs from the concept of separation of church and state.
Well, it's not that different from the separation of church and state. It's just that over the years, the government, the state, has assumed more and more areas, more and more programs, more and more activities which properly belong in the realm of society. Things like taking care of the disadvantaged, the poor, the elderly, things that are societal things. Because as a libertarian, I believe that the role of government is to protect the rights and property of the citizens. And that's it, because everything else beyond that becomes a battle over special interests. And what's happened is, as I already mentioned, the cost of government in Pennsylvania has been rising at more than three times the rate of inflation. Nationally, the story is even worse, because federal budget is, what, $3.5 trillion right in around there? The cost of the welfare state is about $2.2 trillion, and that includes Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, food stamps, all those programs. But federal revenues are $2.3 trillion. So virtually every dollar that's coming in the door on the federal level is going out to a giveaway program. Everything else, defense, the White House, Amtrak, NASA, it's all paid for with borrowed dollars. We cannot continue down this path because it's going to bankrupt the country. It's going to bankrupt Pennsylvania. The solution is to take all these societal things and separate them from society, from the state. Now, let me just go right to the, instead of going through all the ins and outs, let me just jump right to the conclusion. What I would suggest is that we create a separate organization called society. It would have a constitution, just like government would. So there would be, at the national level, a president of society and a congress of society. At the state level, there would be a governor of society and a state house of society. Locally, there would be a mayor of society and a town council of society. It would look just like government, except for one important difference. Society would not have the coercive power of taxation. That means that at the national level, sure, they could pass a Social Security Act to help the elderly, but they couldn't garnish your wages to pay for it. They would have to ask for the money voluntarily. And if there wasn't enough money to pay for these programs, then the government, or excuse me, society would have to do just what you and I have to do when we don't have enough money to pay for our initiatives. We tighten our belts. We prioritize. And in government's case, they can hold a fundraiser. They do a bake sale, whatever it may be, to raise the funds. Because Americans are very giving people. I mean, just look what happened after Hurricane Katrina. The Red Cross was overwhelmed with donations. But if we set up a separate organization called Society, which would be the focal point for all of these well-meaning programs, we can start transitioning them out of the state one by one, program by program. And as we do that, we cut the cost of the state little by little. So instead of bankrupting the state, instead of 60% of the federal budget going to giveaway programs, we can cut it to 50%, to 40%, to 30%. and eventually all of these activities, all these programs, would be transferred over to society. And that's the way it would work. And that way, we wouldn't be bankrupting our society, because society wouldn't have that coercive power of taxation. Because right now, they just keep reaching into our pockets and taking more money. And a lot of these programs, they're wasteful. They're just pork barrel spending. They're special interest spending. But if we move them over to society, people just aren't going to contribute to them. So that they're going to be it's going to be a way of reforming the welfare state as well. So that's it in a very large nutshell.
Very interesting. I definitely would like to hear more of that. That's a very interesting concept. And so now we'll move on to specific issues. Go ahead.
I was going to just mention that my novel, Atlas Snubbed, presents the separation of society and state as fiction. And it also presents a few other separation of courts and states, separation of regulation and state. But we can get into that later. But it's all in my book, Atlas Snubbed.
You have to check that out. Sounds pretty cool. Anyway, we're going to go over to such specific issues. And first, let's get your thoughts on both our, of course, the United States and the Pennsylvania Constitution. Two things. One, of course, you heard the phrase, believe that they're a living, breathing document. And so what's your thoughts on that? And also, I'd like to point out that the government or public schools, as you pointed out on your website, do not teach your state constitution. And I speculate this is happening in states throughout the country. So please tell us why you think this is so, and what would you do as governor to bring back the discussion in school?
Well, let me take your questions one at a time. First of all, I don't believe that the Constitution is a living document. I think words mean what words mean, and the minute you start stretching beyond them, you wind up with the mess we have today. So when the Pennsylvania Constitution says the right of the citizens to bear arms in defense of themselves and the state shall not be questioned, I have no question what that means. Now, of course, when other candidates are talking about limiting gun purchases or things like that, how can they uphold their oath to the Constitution when they're blatantly violating it? Now, as to why they're not teaching it in the schools, that's a great question. You know, it's funny because government controls the schools lock, stock, and barrel. They say who can teach, who can't teach, what gets taught, what doesn't get taught, who goes to school, who doesn't have to go to school, how many days you have to go to school, how many hours in the day you've got to stay there. And with all that power, nowhere do they teach the Pennsylvania Constitution. Now, me personally, I never knew Pennsylvania had a constitution until after I was in my 20s, and I never read it until I got into my 30s. So this is not just me. This is across the state. In fact, last time I ran for governor, more than half of my public appearances were at schools. And I would always ask the question. I'd say, how many of you have read the Pennsylvania Constitution? And Robert, all you hear is crickets. And then I'd say, well, this microphone must be broken. Hello? Hello? Can you hear me? But they don't teach it. And there are so many reasons why you can speculate why they don't teach it. Well, first of all, I mentioned Article 1, Section 21, the right to bear arms shall not be questioned. Now, can you imagine teaching that to the kids? And also, Article 1 is our Declaration of Rights. This is written in part by William Penn, Benjamin Franklin, and this goes back hundreds of years. But one of the most important parts of Article 1 is Section 25, which says that all of Article 1 is removed from the power of government and shall forever remain inviolate. So the right to bear arms is a right that the government can never touch. And I always talk to the students and I say, what other things are in here that they don't want you to know? One of my favorites, I have lots of favorites in there, but another one is Article 1, Section 2, which says the people have at all times the right to alter, reform, or abolish their government in whatever manner they see fit. So we have the right of revolution here in Pennsylvania. And it's not us petitioning the legislature saying, oh, please, can we have a referendum? No. The people have at all times. These are things they've taken away from us. Now, I can go on about the Constitution. Matter of fact, I have a standard speech. As you mentioned in my intro, I'm a professional public speaker, and one of the things I like to talk about is the Pennsylvania Constitution. But let me tell you, as governor of Pennsylvania, what I would like to do is see the Constitution taught more. Now, Right now, education in Pennsylvania is controlled by an unelected board of education in Harrisburg, and I think it's one of the worst possible ways of doing it. Now, the impetus is overwhelming to say, well, I'm just going to order them to do that, to teach the Pennsylvania Constitution. And I can do that, and I will do that. But what I would like to see is that we change education fundamentally in Pennsylvania. Because right now, 90%, 95% of the kids in Pennsylvania all go to the same school system, the government school system. It's a virtual monopoly. So like all monopolies, the costs are high, choice is low, and the quality, it's not always the best, especially if you're looking at places like Philadelphia. So what I want to do is I want to introduce competition into the schools. And the way I would do that is to bring somebody into the equation who's been left out for too long, and that's the parents. Specifically, what I would like to see is that the parents could choose any government school for their child, and the funding which would have gone to their local school will follow the child to the school of the parents' choice. That way, good schools get more funding and grow, and the bad schools get less and less funding until they're forced to shut down. So for the same educational dollar, we can improve the quality of education, get better education for our kids, and be able to reform the less quality, not as good schools. Let me take a breath there because I want to give you a chance to give a couple of words in edgewise. Because yes, a triple question. There's, I had to give you a triple answer.
Yeah, fine. And I do have a habit of asking multiple questions in one question. We'll move on because, you know, I definitely have many more of my panelists will probably have some comments and questions themselves. But one of the things you mentioned earlier tonight, you talked about crime. And one of the things you state is that there are things that a governor can do, because there will be other people, of course, who will read your site, and they may have this type of question when you say that a governor can do unilaterally without the consent of legislators to reduce crime, and I plan to inaugurate them on my first day in office. Now, some
Correct.
May have the thought that that mindset is not much different than what Obama has been doing. What would your response be to folks who would make that connection?
I'm not sure how you'd make a connection between what I said and what Mr. Obama has said. Could you please clarify that?
Sure. Well, some, you know, when he says that, you know, with a stroke of a pen, he doesn't need the legislature in order to, you know, some folks might misread that and think, okay, wait a minute, this is what Obama is doing. You know, he's saying with a stroke of a pen, he stated that he doesn't need a legislature in order for him to get things passed. Some might say, well, how's that different than what Obama's would do?
Oh, I understand what you're asking. The key difference is that I have read the Constitution and I understand the powers that it grants to the governor. What Mr. Obama is suggesting doing, there is nothing in the Constitution which says he can do that. It says Congress shall pass the law and he shall sign it. He's not allowed to change it. He can't do signing statements. He can't ignore parts of it. If he chooses not to execute part of the law, then he's liable for impeachment because it's his job to enforce the law. He is the executor of the law. So when he says that he doesn't need the Congress to do something, he's stepping outside the bounds. There's no constitutional authority for what he's doing. But the things that I'm doing, if you look specifically in the Constitution, it says the governor has the right of the veto and the line item veto. The governor and the lieutenant governor together work with the Board of Pardons, with the Board of Parole. So these are all things that the Constitution says that I can do. This isn't me saying it, like Mr. Obama is just making this up out of thin air. This is the Constitution saying that. And I would urge people to read the Constitution and hold Mr. Obama's feet to the fire for the things that he's not allowed to do. And also, if they see something that I'm saying that I can do that I can't, hold my feet to the fire. I was at an event at a local Patriot group with Bob Guzzardi, who is the Republican candidate for
yes,
governor in the primary. He's a good
mm-hmm.
guy. I like that. And I was up on and I was saying the same thing. Pardon nonviolent drug offenders and end parole veto, line item veto, return forfeited assets, all of these things. Bob got up after me and he says, Ken is exactly right. He's not over-promising. These are all things that are guaranteed by the Constitution. So there's an independent voice who agreed with me. And I didn't even have to pay him to say it. No, not that I would.
No, great, yeah.
And not that Bob.
We had him on there, on the show. And that for folks who would like to hear more of the Bob Guzzardi interview, all of our shows are archived for later listening, and you can also download them. I mean, I've got some episodes downloaded on my phone. You can put them on a CD, and people can listen to cars later. You can share the link with folks in email, so they're very accessible to listen to the shows later, and all the shows, as I said, are archived, so you can listen to that one. And so I'll move on to the next topic, and most topic that most of the audience believe ought to be a crime, and that is abortion. And I must say that, you know, through reading your stuff, is your approach to abortion is much more logical than, I must admit, other libertarian guests that have been on the show and how they would approach it. And just a little caveat here, I'm a big Star Trek fan myself. Spock is my favorite character on Star Trek. So when I read that you talked about Captain Kirk, I was like, oh, my gosh, this is great. I can't wait to talk to this guy. But what are you talking now? One of the things you mentioned I want to have you explain this on, because, I mean, it's great, and I recommend anyone listening to the show to visit the website, which I'll have you give folks later, and check out everything, especially on this about abortion, because, you know, most folks here, you know, are, you know, pro-life. But talk about your pro-option plan, and what do you mean by that, and give some details on it.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. You know, people ask me, they say, are you pro-life or pro-choice? I say, yes, I am. And they're like, what? I said, because we can change things around right now, because the abortion debate it's divided. I mean, it's badly divided. And it doesn't need to be, because we, with just one small change to the law, we can save babies and preserve a woman's right to choose. Specifically, what I would like to see happen is that we legalize prenatal adoption. Now, that would mean that if a woman doesn't want her unborn child, anybody could step forward and adopt it while it's still in the womb. And then, through the privacy of the doctor, they could ask the woman, please bring the baby to term. She could say yes or no. Now, if she says yes, of course the adopting parents will pay for the delivery. And in that case, we've just saved a baby. And since so many babies are aborted for economic reasons, we're guaranteed to decrease the number of abortions. And we're still preserving the woman's right to choose. The woman has the right to say yes or no, but if she says yes, we've saved the baby. Now that's the easy straight line answer, just by introducing prenatal adoption. What if the woman says no? Now again, through the doctor, the adopting parents could ask the woman, hold on to the baby long enough that safe delivery could be done. Maybe, what is it, about 6-7 months now, a baby can be safely delivered. And again, the woman could say yes or no. Now, granted, it's going to be more expensive, the delivery, but again, the adopting parents would pay for it. Now, there are a lot of reasons why a woman would not want to hold a baby to term. There could be professional reasons, it could be family reasons, whatever they are. But some women would say yes. So, we're guaranteed to save more babies and preserve a woman's right to choose simultaneously. Now, that's at the far end. Let's look at the early end. Suppose a woman finds out that she's pregnant. Now, in the animal kingdom, we routinely do embryo transplants, and it wouldn't take a lot of research to take those techniques and move them over to humans, because we're already doing in vitro fertilizations. It'd just be expanding upon that same idea. So that would mean that at the early end, I guess up to 6 weeks, 8 weeks, they'd be able to take the fetus and transplant it into a host mother. Again, the adopting parents would pay for that. And also, those people who truly care about the unborn would fund research to be able to make sure that that could be done safely. And that research can continue. And call me an idealist, but it may take 50 years, it may take 100 years, but I see that delivery period, the transplant could be done 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 1 month, 2 months, and that safe delivery period could go from 7 months, 6 months, 5 months, 4 months. Eventually, those two would cross, and no unborn baby would ever need die. So that's the long-term goal. It may take 50 years or 100 years, but that's what we're looking at. by one small change to the abortion laws to allow for prenatal adoption, we can end this divisive title, this whole abortion thing. And you know, Robert, I've taken this idea to the abortion clinics on Sunday mornings, where you've got all the pro-life people on one side, the pro-choicers on the other. And I've gone to the pro-lifers and say, listen, here's a way we can save more babies. And they love the idea. And I go over to the pro-choicers and say, here's a way we can preserve your right to choose and keep them happy. And they love the idea, too. I say, all right, let's come on together and talk now. And like, no, keep me away from those baby killers. No, keep me away from those Nazis. And it's like Solomon says, let it be divided. But this is a way out. This is probably the only way out that I've ever heard of, which can finally defuse this abortion debate and allow women the right to choose while still saving babies. And there's a Mr. Spock line.
Very fascinating is the word I'll use for it.
Thank you.
I'll use the term fascinating for that plan. It's definitely, as I said, definitely the best one I've heard from, you know, I must be honest, the other libertarians that have come onto the show. So I really like that. But now that that's a topic I'm very passionate about. But now that one of my favorite topics is, and those folks who know me well on the show and the audience members who've been coming here to a time, and that's the environment. I'm the resident tree hugger here. And so you connect protecting the environment and property rights. So tell us how you think that these two, which many would consider, at least on the left, to be irreconcilable. Go ahead.
Oh, no, Robert, it's the other way around. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's my question. When working in conjunction with protecting property rights and protecting the environment, how can those working in conjunction actually protect our planet?
Well, the only way you can protect the environment is by defending property rights. And it would take, again, a different point of view to be able to see that. So I can understand why some people wouldn't look at it that way. Because I would like to come at protecting the environment from a different approach than what everybody else would do. Specifically, I would like to see any kind of pollution or whatever it may be along those lines, I'd like to see it treated as a trespass. That would mean that if anybody has their junk blowing onto your property, leaking onto your property, you can get an injunction from the courts, as you could against any trespasser, and you could shut them down. You could say, get your junk off my property, clean it up, and if they keep it up, well, you have all of the remedies that are currently available against trespassers, including having cleaning them up or jailing them, whatever it may be. So by defending property rights as a trespass, you could defend against polluters. So that's it. It's a pretty simple idea, and I'm surprised other people haven't suggested it. A lot of these ideas, like that one, the abortion thing, these are all things that I've come up with on my own, the separation of society and state, all of these things. But this would do for any kind of a pollution problem, whether it's the acid rain coming into Pennsylvania from Ohio, we could say, hey, stop your stuff from coming in here. Whether it's the pollen coming in from genetically modified crops, again, stop your trespassing. If it's any kind of pollution coming from fracking, again, you could step in and using trespass, you can have a remedy against them. Because right now, the way they have it set up, they say, oh, you can have 0.0025 parts per million. No, I don't want 0.0025 parts per million. I don't want anything. Or they can trade the right to pollute. I couldn't believe that when I first heard about that you can actually buy the right to pollute. I don't want anybody to pollute. I don't want you to be able to sell the right. I don't want anybody to pollute at all. I want you to get your junk off my property, period. So that's my general approach, and I guess I can get into specifics. I'm waiting to talk to your panel. I'm sure they got 1,000 questions.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And then I just have a couple more here, and then we'll bring them in. So moving on to subjects that, you know, I didn't see on your website, but ones I'm going to address. As a libertarian, what is your view on prostitution? Do you think it ought to be made legal and regulated? And would you propose something on those lines as as governor of Pennsylvania?
Well, I truly like ladies, and I don't think that we should be exploiting them the way we do with our current prostitution laws. So let me back up. When we first got on the show, when I defined a libertarian, generally speaking, on principle, you have the right to live your life your way without interference, provided only that you respect the rights and property of others. Now, if two consenting adults get together and they want to play a game of pinochle or they want to play something else, it is none of my business. It's none of the government's business what they should be doing. And in fact, the current prostitution laws have set it up that the ladies of the night or the gentlemen of the night who want to partake in that line of business, they lose protection of the government for what they're doing. Suppose somebody robs them. Suppose somebody doesn't pay them. So whatever it may be, they have no remedy because they've been put outside of the law. So you have all of the problems related to prostitution we have now, and it's all caused by the laws. So as a libertarian, again, I mentioned earlier when we were talking about I was going to pardon all nonviolent drug offenders, I'm going to use that power of the pardon to broaden that power of the pardon to cover any kind of a quote-unquote victimless criminal. In general, I believe that if there is no victim, there is no crime. So if a prostitute wants to get together with somebody else, who is the victim there? There's not a victim. It's a capitalist exchange of goods for service. So I think the government should get out of it. And if any of those cases come up before me as I see them as governor, I will pardon the people involved, provided they've dealt honestly with each other. Of course, if they've robbed from each other, if they got kids involved or whatever it is, then, yeah, they're going to go to jail, no question about it. But if they were just kicking back watching The Simpsons and playing around, they've got to get out of jail free card from this governor. No victim, no crime.
Okay,
I'm a Prince old guy.
Yeah, I missed what you said there.
I'm sorry. I missed
Nick,
that.
Oh, no, that's okay. I'm going to be moving on to the economy and an issue with the economy. I'm not bringing this up to other candidates, so I'm going to bring it up to you. Of course, as you know, the economy has been rough for many years, for many folks in the last 6 years, I would say. And there are those who are still out of work or severely underpaid looking for better work. The economic downturn and hardships have made a lot of hardworking people's credit deteriorate from increasing debt and the ability to pay what debts they have and even bills and necessities, such as gas, groceries, things of that nature. Now, currently, many employers require credit checks in order for applicants to be considered for employment. Now, I think this is a huge hindrance for many under and unemployed in America to get jobs or even better paying jobs. As a governor, what would you do about this issue?
Well, there's a couple of aspects to that. First one, the reason why the economy is so bad is because taxes are just way too high. They're just sucking all of the life out of the economy. And as governor, I will be reducing taxes, and that will improve the job market in Pennsylvania. More companies will want to come to Pennsylvania because they'll find that it's a much friendlier place from a business point of view. So the economy will move up, just generally speaking, all across Pennsylvania. So that's something I could do on a broader scale. Now, when you start looking at the individual ones, again, as a libertarian, I believe you have the right to live your life your way without interference, provided you're respecting the rights and property of others. Now, I've run my own information technology consulting firm for over a quarter century now. And the last thing I would want is for the government to step in and start dictating to me how to run that company. Because whenever government does that, it's always a one-size-fits-none solution. Legally speaking, the government has no right to step in, nullify a contract between two people. So if I want to hire people who are only of a certain technical competence level, then that's what I'm going to hire. I don't want to hire people who are not able to do the job. So I think that businesses should be allowed to set their own rules for how they should be hiring people. Now, in a lot of cases, it may seem unfair, like doing a credit check, and I've had people do credit checks on me for employment. It's going to reach a point where they're not going to be able to find the people they want for the dollars that they're paying or whatever it is they're doing. I know people, for example, who won't work for a company who requires a drug test just because they feel that it extends too far into their privacy. And generally speaking, if you don't like the way a company is conducting their business, you don't do business with them. If the company discriminates against women or discriminates against minorities, you boycott them. That happened not too long ago with McDonald's. They wanted McDonald's to pay a different wage. I thought that was a great idea because the people went directly to McDonald's. They didn't go to their legislature saying, hold a gun to the head of McDonald's and make them pay us more money. No, they boycotted McDonald's, hit them in the pocketbook where it really hurts. That's the exact same thing that Rosa Parks did way back when she wouldn't give up her seat in the bus. All of the black community in Montgomery, Alabama, refused to ride the buses. And what they did, they boycotted the buses. That boycott lasted over a year. They drove the bus company to the brink of bankruptcy before they finally changed those Jim Crow laws. This is the sort of thing that we need to do. If a company is not conducting themselves in a friendly manner, don't do business with them. Eventually, they're going to get the message. And that's happened time and time again in history. And the last thing I would do as governor would be to hold a gun to the head of any company and say, do things my way. Because as a libertarian, I believe you have the right to do things your way, provided you're respecting the rights and property of others. Answer the question?
Okay, well, I definitely disagree a little bit with that, just because, you know, you have a lot of companies, especially those who are better paying, better paying companies, jobs, things of that nature, where they're doing these, you know, because I know some folks who, you know, they're hardworking. They just, you know, at one point in their life fell on some hard times when, unfortunately, it affected their credit. And, of course, they weren't able to get better or even any jobs if they got laid off. They're hard workers, but got laid off. And, of course, with no income coming in, then, you know, it makes it hard to keep that credit going. And then when they try to get a good paying job afterwards, they weren't able to, because these companies, you know, required that you had a certain credit score in order to even gain employment. Though, and it's increasing that many more of your, as I said, higher paying companies are doing those practices. So I'm saying that it's even a hindrance to bettering the economy in the United States.
I don't know that it's as pervasive as you think, but that would mean I would have to betray my principles for me to step in and tell somebody else how to run their life. And I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to do that, because you have the right to live your life your way as long as you respect the rights and property of others. Because a lot of times when the government steps in and does things like that, it's counterproductive. Take, for example, the minimum wage laws. What they do is they reduce the number of people that can be employed. So, for example, if the government dictates that I pay a certain wage, I only have so much money that I have available to pay wages. So I would have to hire fewer people. So because of the actions of government, there would be more unemployed. And then, of course, people are going to say, oh, now we need a program for them. So here's the government, which caused the problem, and now they're going to start paying unemployment, which is going to raise taxes, again, on these companies, and they're going to be able to hire fewer people. Going to the government and looking for a solution to these problems is like going to a doctor to have him set your broken leg when he's the guy who broke your leg in the first place. The problem is the government stepping in. So the more of these laws that they make, the worse it gets. I mean, I could do other examples, but minimum wage is probably one of the most obvious ones. So I have to disagree with you on that one, Robert.
We'll just have to agree to disagree. I mean, I do agree on the point with the, you know, with the minimum wage. I do agree on that. It's just, you know, requiring that of someone to be employed, because you're presuming, that's a presumption. I'll end it with this, is that a company's presuming that because someone, you know, his credit is not what they deem it should be, that they are not good workers. And so not giving them the employment that otherwise they probably qualify for and deserve. But I do have one thing. We already talked about the legalization of drugs. But the last issue we'll talk about before I bring in the panelists is, and we'll spend just a little bit of time on this, is your stance on the LGBT issues.
Excuse me. Well, I think you could take a good guess what that is, because I believe you have the right to live your life your way without interference, provided only that you respect the rights and property of others. So from my point of view, it doesn't matter to me who you want to hang out with. It doesn't matter to me whether or not you want to get married or not. Who am I to stand in the way of true love? Who is the government to stand in the way of true love? I don't think the governments have any say at all about it. When it comes to the question of gay marriage or whatever it may be, I have one of my favorite sound bites, and this goes back to my 2002 campaign. What's good for the goose and the gander is good for the goose and the goose and the gander and the gander. It's none of the government's business. And all this buzz right now about gay marriage, it's finally coming to the general attention of America. This is something else I was talking about in 2002. It was cutting edge in 2002. Today, it's common wisdom. And when people ask me, well, I bet you're real happy now that the state is allowing for gay marriage. No, I'm not happy. Do you know why? Because it's none of the government's business who gets married. That's another aspect of society and state where we need to separate society and state. Government has no right at all to issue marriage licenses. And you know, Robert, most people don't know this. Do you know the first marriage licenses were issued to prevent interracial marriages? Did you know that?
Yeah, I believe I read something about it some time ago.
Most people don't. But now, today, they're using those same racist techniques to prevent honest citizens from getting together and getting married. So
I'd have to contend that the debate over the, you know, because of course we talk about, you know, these issues a lot on the show, and I would contend that the debate of the gay marriage issue hasn't as much to do with the, you know, the if a man and a man or a woman want to, you know, have a civil union, let's say, and then have the same rights. As because you can have a civil union and have the same rights such as insurance and things of that nature. It's when they bring the marriage aspect into it, and you know, frankly, you know, when people think of a marriage, they usually think of your, you know, or at least as a religious ceremony and bringing religion into it. And I think that's where a lot of the debate of, you know, of the marriage thing, because they can get the same rights as, you know, someone who's married in a civil union. So I think it's just semantics that, you know, the community is arguing for. I don't care if a guy wants to marry a guy, a girl wants to marry a girl. I don't care if they want to marry their dog. I don't care. But my biggest issue is, and we won't talk about this at length because I do want to bring the panelists in, is when you bring children involved, saying that I've got some questions about on whether, you know, when you have the adoption and things of that nature of same-sex parents. So.
I think you have the right to
bringing in another human being.
That's true, but they're still loving parents, whether there's, you know, guy, girl, or whatever. They're still parents, and they deserve all of the same benefits that any couple would have. To deny them, you're actually making them second-class citizens. I'm against the second-class citizenship. So across the board, I would just say that any boon that is available to any citizen should be available to any citizen. The law must be equal for all. You can't push one person higher or hold another person down. So if we get government out of the marriage business completely, and I agree with you when you say we should have something like civil unions. I don't like to call it civil unions. For some reason, people don't like that term. What I would like to have instead is just a little checklist saying, well, let's say, Robert, you and I decided we're going to mix our fortunes. So a little checklist. Are we going to have the right of inheritance? Yes, no. Are we going to have medical power of attorney? Yes, no. And then we both sign this, notarize it, and file it with the state. And the state's only role would be to defend that contract. So if I suddenly say, oh, I'm not going to let you, you know, get my inheritance, well, now you can go to the state to enforce your rights. And that's the role of the government, to protect the rights and property of the citizens. But anything beyond that, you know, whether they're going to stop a citizen from doing something that another citizen can do, I'm against that. I'm against second-class citizenships.
Okay. Well, we brought that all up. I've been through all of my questions that I had for you. We'll open up the line to the panelists in order of their calling in. And then tonight, James has called in first, and then we'll have Dan and then Kelly. And if anyone out there would like to join our roundtable discussion, you are welcome to speak with us at 347-945-7428. But, of course, before I bring the panelists in, I must direct folks to the Bard's Logic Political Talk website by going to www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And, of course, have folks check out our Give page, which we have some wonderful organizations and groups there that could need your help and would greatly appreciate it. And we also, of course, have the sponsors and affiliate page, so check them out, because, of course, visiting and supporting the sponsors and affiliates, your support will help Bard's Logic, the Grassroots with the People show. So check out the Go Sun Stove, and also the new affiliate we have on here, which is the Green Cycler Composter, the composter at home. They have videos on there on the website to give you more information about that. So please check out our page at www.bardslogicphototalk.com and check out the Give and Sponsor Affiliate pages as well as the other pages we have there. So at this time, without any further ado, I will open up. Go ahead.
I was going to say, and be sure to check out my website, too. It's kenk.org, K-E-N-K.org.
Could you say that again? I missed it. Your website.
It is kenk.org, K-E-N-K.org. Because, you know, I also have kenkrawchuk.com, but people have trouble spelling kenkrawchuk.com. So kenk.org is what it is.
Very good. That's great. And definitely look up more, my opinion, look up more on his ideas, especially with the abortion issue. I think those were, as said, fascinating. And so, James, I have your mic open. Thank you very much for calling to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Robert, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing pretty good. I spent about 2 hours in a dentist chair yesterday, so I'm recovering from that. But beyond that, I'm doing pretty good.
Yeah, always a joy. I hope they gave you the nitrous anyway. So
No, it was just an initial appointment. It was just, you know, poking and prodding and checking things out. So new dentist.
Yeah, that's about the only good thing to going to the dentist is the nitrous. Other than that, it's pretty well not much of a fun day.
Yeah, that's what they said. They said y'all would enjoy the nitrous. I've never, you know, but well, I tell you what, though. I mean, I do not like dentists. I'll be honest. I am not. I would not avoid them like the plague. But I tell you what, these were the nicest folks, and they were great and very friendly, and they were just phenomenal. That made me very comfortable. Well, as comfortable as I can be. But I tell you what, they were great. And it was Laura Schiller. What's the name? And anyone listening in the area here in Ohio, definitely you're looking for a dentist. Laura Schiller, I'll tell you what, on Glenway Avenue, that's the place to check out. Go ahead, James.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's fine. No, it's just it's an interesting show. You know, when I heard that your guest is a libertarian, the first thing I thought of was the Democrat Party-backed libertarian candidate there that you know altered the election there in Virginia. And so I have to admit I have a little bit of trepidation and caution when it comes to libertarian candidates, but you said a lot of things that I agree with, and so thank you. You've restored a little bit of faith there in me.
Thank you.
A question that I had, though, in regards to the gay marriage thing, because, you know, this is a big topic, of course, with a lot of conservatives. They're just completely against it. But I think that there is nothing in the Constitution, regardless of what people's personal opinions are, that states that it should be illegal. And that, you know, this we know. And you were spot on about how marriage licenses were originally created to prevent interracial marriages. And so kudos again to you for knowing your history.
Thank you.
The question I have in regards to that is one of the contentions that's going on in states where it is legal or where same-sex couples move to, or rather, well, I guess it is only going on right now where it is legal, is there are people that own businesses that have a religious conviction against same-sex marriage, and they're being sued out of business for refusing to do business with a with a couple, you know, wishes to have a same-sex marriage. Do you feel that they should be able to do that, or should the person's constitutional right of freedom of religion allow them, just like the business signs very often say, is they have the right to refuse service to anyone? Certainly there would be another possible business that would do business with them.
Yes.
Do you think that a same-sex couple should be able to file a lawsuit against somebody that has a religious objection to a couple who's seeking supplies for a same-sex marriage?
Well, I'll go back to my stand on my principles that you have the right to live your life your way without interference, provided only that you respect the rights and property of others. So that would mean that if you choose not to marry, if you're a church that doesn't want to marry a gay couple, God bless you, then you're not going to do it. And as you just pointed out, there are a lot of other people who would do that. Again, I'm in favor of the total separation of society and state, that if somebody wants the recognition of a church as being quote-unquote married in that church's opinion, then it's the church that can say yay or nay to that. Let me give you a real local example. My hometown of Abington tried to create exactly that sort of an ordinance where you could move against a company or any organization if they turned you down because of sexual orientation. But one of our local preachers, who's like, wait a minute, that means I could be sued for not marrying a gay couple, but it's against my religion to do this. And this is a total misuse of the power of government. And the problem here is that is passing these laws which allow people to sue based upon an individual conviction. And as I was saying earlier, what that does, that creates a second-class citizenship. And I'm against that. I'm definitely against that. We shouldn't have those laws. You shouldn't be allowed to sue somebody on something as personal as that. Because, you know, what next? You're going to make churches pay for abortions? I mean, in their mind, that's murder of a human being. How can you make them pay for that? It's the whole thing's a can of worms. I'd be against it.
Well, I suspected based on what you'd said that would be your response, and the only common sense solution to the entire issue is to get government completely out of it.
You know,
there's plenty of denominations. I mean, honestly, when it boils down to it, it's marriage licenses are two things. One, they're a form of discrimination that's enabled by the government, and two, it's a tax. It's another way to take away our freedom by taking away from our pocketbook.
That's true. But here in Pennsylvania, we actually have a way around that. We have it's called a self-officiating marriage, where the Quakers are the ones who brought it in, where you can have anybody preside over a wedding. And it's interesting because my eldest daughter was the officiant at a friend of ours' wedding. So she actually stood up there asking the question, do you so-and-so take such-and-such, you know, and the whole thing. And there was no marriage license. There was nothing. Of course, there was a piece of paper at the end where the husband and wife signed it, and the witnesses signed it, and Melanie signed it. And they sent it off to the state, and it's a valid marriage. Didn't have to pay anything. So I'm not sure what state you're in, but in Pennsylvania, we already have a way around that.
Well, I live in Oklahoma, and they're very controlling in a lot of their laws, let's just put it politely.
That brings me to a question. I'm going to, real quick, gentlemen, this is a question I want to ask, and I thought you were going to ask it, James, just as your, you know, words are rolling off your tongue, like they're going to ask it, but you didn't. But what about there are states who, of course, there are some states where it's legal, where, you know, same-sex marriage is legal, but there's other states that are where it's still not legal. And so a couple who got married in, let's say, New York moves to, I think, Ohio, where it's still technically, I still believe it's illegal here in Ohio. So where now they're saying that if you lived in New York and got married in New York where it's legal and you go to Ohio, let's say, for instance, where it's not, where now the federal government is trying to force Ohio to recognize that marriage, even though it's not legal in the state. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, if you've read the federal constitution, it says in there, and I'm not going to be able to quote the exact section, but it says that each state shall give full faith and credence to the laws of every other state. So if I get married in Pennsylvania and I move to one of these less liberal states, then I'm still married. They can't undo that. It just does not change anything. So the federal government, since the states have given that right to the government, the federal government has every right to say to these other states, no, these people do remain married. So that's something in the federal government. Now, if you don't think that belongs in the federal constitution, then we need to amend the constitution and take it out of there. But since the federal government was created by the states, they granted certain powers to the federal government, certain enumerated powers, and one of them is that the laws of one state, all the other states shall respect them. And that's one part of the Constitution that is routinely ignored, but here's one case where I guess they're following up on it.
Hey, and Kelly, he's on the line, and we'll be bringing out shortly. We may have something to say on that as well. But we will bring in the person who called in next for the show, and that is our contributor, Dan Gray. And he's also a speaker of some renown there. He's over also in Pennsylvania. So thank you very much, Dan, for coming to the show. How are you?
Oh, pretty good. Thanks, Bob. And, Ken, it's awesome to hear you again. If folks think Ken is great on the radio, I've heard him speak in person. Toastmasters certainly did you good. So.
Thank you, Dan.
And on a local note, don't get him started. He'll tell you about Toastmasters. And he can we're talking politics tonight. And
no,
on a personal note, one of our first elected, and I say our, I'm not a Libertarian Party member at this moment. I've been going back and forth with parties trying to make my vote count as much as I can. And luckily, in our general election, doesn't matter what you're registered as long as you're registered. But Sean Felty, one of the first Libertarians elected Pennsylvania from a nearby town, Cressona, not far from me here in the coal regions, he says hi. I'd like to anticipate Kelly. He's going to be asking you about the U.S. Constitution, which you've already shown some real knowledge on. If I mentioned the Pennsylvania Constitution, Article 1, Section 5, does that strike a bell with you?
It does. That's the one that says all elections shall be free and equal. And that's one part of our Constitution they ignore completely. Do you know that in order for me to get my name on the ballot? Yeah.
Well, you're anticipating my question. I know. Bob Gizzardi to get on the ballot, and Bob is a friend of yours and mine as well. He needed 2,000 because he ran as a Republican. He got on the ballot, and the Supreme Court booted him off, which I thought was wrong, but, you know, that's what they did. In any case, he's not on the ballot, and you're not yet. 2,000 is what it took for Tom Wolf, who's our current Democratic nominee, and 2,000 is what it took for Tom Corbett, who was the incumbent, who is our current Republican in-name-only nominee. And how many signatures will you need to be on the ballot this fall?
Oh, not many. Only 16,639, more than eight times as many, even though Article 1, Section 5 of our Constitution says all elections shall be free and equal. I guess some people are more equal than others. Don't get me started.
That's a very apposite quote. Now, we mentioned high taxes, and I think that's absolutely correct to cut taxes. The Commonwealth Foundation just had an article out today I read, which was a very good academic piece that cited several really good studies, including studies done in other countries of America. And it said that basically high taxes are created by corruption. Pennsylvania rated number 10 per capita, but when you count it in terms of every 10,000 government employees, because we get a lot of them, I'm one of them, we're actually number one. And there's so many opportunities for corruption. We've got prisons. We've got roads to be built. There's all these grants. The federal government comes in with strings where they say, hey, you have to do this if you want that. And we have situations where we're paying the money to the feds who take their cut, and they're putting it back into the states with rules on things like Common Core, welfare, unemployment compensation, where I work. How would you deal with that the mass of corrupt individuals and businesses and federal and state bureaucrats who would fight you as governor? How could you get through that?
Well, you actually mixed a couple of concepts in there. The idea of the federal strings on money, I don't know that I would call that corruption, because that's something that Pennsylvania stepped into voluntarily. For example, if we accept transportation money, we have to then accept the Fed's definition of a DUI at 0.08 blood alcohol level. What we've done there is we've sold our liberty to the federal government, and all in exchange for federal dollars. So federal dollars, accepting them is like accepting free drugs from a drug dealer on the corner. You know, here, take a little. It's free. You'll like it. It won't hurt you. But then the next thing you know, you're hooked. And that's just what happened to Pennsylvania. We're hooked on federal dollars. What I would do is I will veto any law that is going to increase the dependence that Pennsylvania has on federal dollars. Because I don't know if you've seen one of my favorite activities. If somebody asks me about getting federal dollars for something, I'll pull a dollar out of my wallet and I'll say, you know what happens when you send a dollar to Washington? And I'll tear it into a big piece and little piece, and I'll throw the big piece over my shoulder, crumble it up. I say most of it vanishes in the bureaucracy. And this smaller piece, this is what comes back to the state. But then the state, and I'll rip it again, has its own bureaucracy, and I'll throw away the bigger piece, and I'll just have a little sliver. And I'll say, and this is what comes back to you. You're lucky if you get a dime on the dollar back from the money that you sent to Washington. And if you kept that money local, you would help 10 times as many people. You would have 10 times as much impact on whatever it is you're trying to solve. So I'd definitely be against accepting any kind of federal dollars, because it's a bad economic deal. It's a bad deal for freedom, and we lose so much in that. So now that's half of your question. The other half is the corruption issue. Well, you're right about Pennsylvania being so corrupt. My own state senator, Leanna Washington, is now under corruption charges. She was using her own staff to run her reelection campaign. And there are so many worse examples. For example, Carlo Romanelli, a green guy running for U.S. Senate a couple years ago, the Democrats challenged his petitions. He turned in 98,000 as a record for Pennsylvania. We had to have 67,000 signatures that year. He turned in 98,000. And they challenged him. The Democrats challenged him. And they disqualified signature after signature for stupid reasons. If you signed where you should have printed and printed where you should have signed, oh, bad signature. If you weren't registered to vote, even though there's no requirement for that, oh, bad signature. If they misspelled their name, or if William Smith signed his name Bill Smith, oh, bad signature. Point is, they got him below the minimum number, and they not only did they kick him off the ballot, they fined him $80,000 just because he tried to get on the statewide ballot.
They did the same thing to Ralph Nader when he ran. And I don't necessarily agree with Ralph Nader on a lot of points, but if he came to my door or somebody came in his place and asked me to sign a petition simply to give people the opportunity to have a choice, I don't see anything wrong with that. That's what the idea of representative democracy is supposed to be. Let's move on to
one more thing, James, because I was going to a point with Carl. Because what happened with Carl is it turned out that one of the high-ranking Democratic state representatives was using state money and state workers to challenge his petitions. So it turned out not only was Carl fined $80,000, his own tax dollars were being used against him to fine him. Now, the guy was eventually convicted, and he went to jail, and he's in jail right now for having done that. And Carl says, oh, since the guy stole the money and he's a corrupt guy, let me go to the courts and say, overturn my fine, please. And the court says, no, that's okay. We'll leave the fine in place. So anyway, there's corruption all over the place. And as governor, I would step in and direct the attorney general to prosecute all of these cases aggressively, especially when they use our own tax money against us.
Well, that only works if you have an attorney general, unlike Kathleen Kane, who chooses what law she wants to enforce or not. Let's talk just briefly, because I know Kelly's going to come on soon, about the idea of marriage. And Bob, by the way, Robert, I am not in favor of anybody marrying their dog. Sorry, I'm not a PETA person, but that's just, dogs cannot give informed consent. But I did like the idea that you said that if we had government not issuing marriage licenses at all, there would be no issue of gay marriage at all. It would be contracts. I can form a contract with anyone I want to have the power of attorney, or to have access to my bank accounts, or to share a home, or to have custody of the children, dogs, vehicles, anything I want to, right to visit the hospital. So this brings us to the idea of voluntary associations. Before I ask the question, I just want to say to James Neighbors that Ken Krawchuk is not a libertarian candidate like the one in Virginia. First of all, nobody's giving big money from the Democrats that I'm aware of, and he would tell us if they did. His commitment to liberty in Pennsylvania is long term. He's been doing this and saying this a long time, and this fresh view, obviously, to all of our listeners, whether you agree or not, you have to admit that Ken has thought these things out in great detail, and he really, these are his issues. He's not just parroting something from a book. In any case, I think he is as likely to win Democrat votes from the Democrat Wolf as Republican votes from Corbett. So to finish my final question for now, voluntary associations, I'm a pro-union guy who hates union corruption. What do you think about the idea of the right to work aspect of law?
Well, I think unions are a great idea. I think compulsory unionization is a bad idea, because I think you have the right to live your life your way without interference, provided only respect the rights and property of others. So I think that sums it up in a nutshell. I mean, that's just the basic principle. So I don't know what more I could say beyond that.
Well, so currently there are quite a few laws in place which make voluntary associations and unions impossible. You have to pay them as a condition of employment in many of the building trades. You have to pay them if you want to work for government. Right now, I have no choice, and you know my backstory. I'm not going to go into it again with the federal lawsuit against Corbett and all the rest of that and SEIU. But the fact is, I had to go to federal court just to get them to kick me loose, and they're still taking money, which, thankfully, I managed to get to go to a charity. But you have to do that on an individual effort every single time. They're taking fantastic amounts of money and perverting the political process for their own ends without anyone say-so. I mean, if they made it voluntary, I would vote for a union. It wouldn't be this one.
Yep.
So what do you do when those laws are in place and there's federal laws as well?
Well, then you work to change the laws. And as governor, I'm not going to do what we were talking about earlier, just play Obama and say, well, I'm just going to do this without you. No, I would use the bully pulpit of the governorship to point out why these things are bad and then work to change those laws one after the other. And one interesting thing about being a libertarian is that the people on the left agree with us on personal freedom issues, and the people on the right agree with us on economic freedom issues. So that would form some interesting coalitions such that we can get rid of some of these nasty laws. So that's pretty much the way I would work with the legislature on that. But I would work to change those. And also, there's a knowledge point of view. I mean, if you've been through it, all right, now you've done it. I would like to get all that out on the web in a transparent way, saying, here's how it's done. I remember when Pennsylvania had their sales tax, they tried to extend it to professional services like computer programmers like my company does. Well, what we did is we published a way saying, well, if you do your invoices this way, then they can't tax it. So, of course, that knowledge got out there, and the next thing you know, Pennsylvania can't tax services. So there are several ways you can attack it. So you can attack it through the legislative process, and I'd use the bully pulpit to do that. And you can attack it through the knowledge process saying, well, here's how you get around it.
Well, you've got the definite point there, where if you get the people behind you, it's very hard for the aristocrats to stand up against that.
I know.
And Bob,
the fall of the Soviet Union.
Oh, yeah. Well, they were aristocrats no matter whether they called themselves communist or not. Bob, I know Kelly is so anxious to get on, and I don't want to hog the mic tonight.
Well,
no problem. Thank you very much. And Kelly, your mic is live. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good, except my head is spinning.
I'm sorry, Kelly.
Yeah, an architect's dream is an engineer's nightmare. So my head is spinning, and I'm hearing all this going on. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I feel like I'm in the land of Oz. You know, we got marriage licenses and unions and big government. Oh, my. So anyway, yeah, let's see, marriage license. What marriage license ever saved a marriage? It's really kind
none.
Of cute.
I've seen it the other way around. I was going to say, I've seen it the other way around, where I said to my wife, hey, we got a license to do this now. But that's just a joke. I'm sorry, Kelly, go ahead.
Yeah, the people serving or not serving people, for whatever reason, that's under the right to contract, Hale versus Henkel, landmark case. You could say, no, I reserve the right to refuse somebody. I mean, that's kind of not necessarily a religious issue. It's more of a right to contract. And I always like, Robert, when you bring libertarians on, because it at times it takes me to higher levels of liberty that I haven't quite understood. I want to start with a simple question for Ken. Protecting the state of Pennsylvania, the citizens of Pennsylvania, versus the feds, like with the right to bear arms and other impositions by the feds, to what level would you go to protect your state?
Well, you go to the level that's necessary. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, the states got together to form the federal government, so we're the ones who are superior to them. So there's all sorts of legal ideas, legal remedies that we can take. And right now, a lot of them are not being exercised. I'm not sure if you're familiar with something called the Sheriff Project, where we're trying to educate the sheriffs on what their powers are. And generally speaking, anytime a federal agent comes into a Pennsylvania county, the first thing they have to do is report to the sheriff to let him know what they're doing, and it has to be legal under Pennsylvania law. And the sheriff can grant or deny them the authority to come into the county. So one thing that I can do as governor is certainly make sure the sheriffs are educated as to what their authority is over the federal government, that they can throw these guys out, whether it's the IRS, the EPA, or whoever, throw them out of their counties. And do you know, the Pennsylvania Constitution gives the governor the power to remove sheriffs for cause. And if the sheriff is letting the federal government overstep their authority, that is cause. So I would be able to remove the sheriff. And guess who appoints the replacement? The governor. And all this is in the Constitution. So,
wow.
All I have to do is replace one or two sheriffs for all the sheriffs to get the idea that this is how you act when it comes to the federal government. So I will be able to hold the federal government at bay when they're doing illegal things. Now, there are legal things,
Kelly,
that they can do. And
makes you want to move to Pennsylvania, doesn't it, Kelly?
Oh, yeah. Beautiful country, too. I've been there.
It is. I love Pennsylvania. You know, I've looked at moving out of the state. You know, they want me to go up the Free State Project up in New Hampshire and other things like that. It's like, forget it. Pennsylvania's too gorgeous. But I digress.
Yeah. What's your stance on, I know we talked a little bit about pro-life / abortion, gay marriage, blah, blah, blah. What's your view on the federal government's involvement or not, or should it be left to the states?
With what, abortion and stuff?
The social issues.
Well, again, we the states got together and formed the federal government. We gave them 17 enumerated powers to coin money, to wage war, different things like that. Nowhere in there does it give them any authority over the murder, if you want to call abortion murder. Nowhere does it give them authority over marriage. Nowhere does it give them authority over any of these things. So even retirement programs like Social Security, we didn't give them that power. We didn't. There are just so many of these things that are just not in the Constitution, and if the federal government tries to exercise any of that power, like education, any of those things, they're overstepping their authority. And we, the states, should step in and stop them. And the way we stop them is under the power granted to the states, that we, the states, reserve to ourselves, I should say, in the 10th Amendment, that we should nullify bad federal laws. If the feds say, well, we now have a law saying your schools have to do A, B, C, we'll say, excuse me, under the 10th Amendment, there's nothing in your Constitution which gives you any authority over education. That law is hereby nullified in Pennsylvania, period. And that would take an act of the legislature to do that.
What if a scenario like this came down to the feds coming back and saying, well, you signed the contract, you got the money. Well, you didn't do it, but the previous governor did.
Yeah, well,
that's kind of a tricky one.
It is, but the law is the law, and you have to follow it. And what I would do is I would, of course, work to undo that. As I mentioned before, accepting federal dollars is like accepting an addictive drug from the drug dealer. Next thing you know, you're hooked, and you have to dance to his tune. And in those cases, we're hooked, and we're dancing to their tune. So I would work – first of all, I would veto any new entanglements like that, and I would work to remove the existing ones. And, you know, one of the worst ones is that 0.08 drug thing. If I could just – digress briefly. I'm a auxiliary policeman here in my hometown, and I worked DUI checkpoint a couple of nights. First night I was there, they hauled 8 people away in irons, and not one of them was visibly drunk. And I went up to the testing officer. I says, hey, what's the deal here? He goes, oh, you don't have to be drunk to be over the limit. So we're hauling away people who are not drunk, who are over the limit. Because we accepted federal dollars, we had to accept that 0.08, and now we're taking innocent people and putting them in prison. But don't get me started.
Oh, I know.
Anyway, I digress.
There's always a confrontation when, well, you signed the contract. People can contract away their constitutional rights, and it's kind of frightening. I wanted to get your take on something that I – and by the way, I like the common law tenet, harm no one, their property, or their rights – by willful injury or neglect. If we ruled that way, so many people would be out of prison immediately, or they would even be in prison because there's no injured party.
That's right.
Yeah.
Well, you're really up on the law, man. You're a knowledgeable guy.
Oh, well,
good stuff, Kelly.
I was about to cite Hale versus Henkel because it's stunning, but I don't have time. All right. Here's something I wanted to get your take on this, okay? Because I've been looking at the progression of how our country is from such freedom and prosperity into this downward spiral, and they always the problem maker wants to be the problem solver and make more solutions that are really problems. It's just government growth all over. But going back to 1787, I came across this coin. It's called the Fugia. Fugia? I don't know how to measure how to pronounce it.
I'm not familiar with it.
Oh, this is stunning. This is, when I learned this, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is completely the spirit of 1776, what they put on the coin.
Yeah.
Can I get your thoughts on this? Okay,
the copper coin you're talking about on Facebook. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I saw one at a coin collector, like $1,400. Really? What is this? What's the first coin? And Benjamin Franklin helped with the design, and it was melted down out of copper from the straps that held the gunpowder barrels together. Gunpowder barrels from France, they took the rungs, they melted them all as copper, they made the coin. And before that, the states, and even the Articles of Confederation, each state could coin their own currency. But they were going, you know, the federal move, which, long story, but this was the first one. And it's like, wow, the history is neat. But you look at the bottom of the coin, and it says this, 3 words. Mind your business. Isn't that stunning? Because that's the spirit of 1776. Government, don't mind my business. I'll take care of my own. and, you know, mind your business, not your neighbors, not use the government to mind your neighbor's business. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it's a great idea, of course. You know, as a libertarian, I think you have the right to live your life your way, not your neighbor's way, not the government's way. And you just live it your way, and you go on your way and make sure you respect the rights and property of others. That's a great motto. That should be on all the coins. Ronald Reagan said something about that. The 11th commandment was mind your own business.
Mm-hmm.
It was Ronald Reagan who said that. Yep. No, I think it's a good idea. That's news to me. I hadn't known any of that.
Yeah, I stumbled across it at a coin collector's. Here's kind of a tricky one for you. Okay.
Yeah.
I'm seeing the problems with the drug war. Okay. It's
insane drug war.
There's a lot of particularly in Mexico, a lot of people are dying before Americans can buy their high-priced drugs. And so you want to go ahead and legalize drugs. Now, what about people who just totally mess up their life doing drugs, and then they want to go to the state for money? Oh, I need disability, or I need Social Security, or I need. Why? Because they messed up your life with drugs.
Mm-hmm.
What's your thoughts on that aspect, and how would, as governor, would you start rewarding people that?
No, there's two sides of that. First of all, the problem with drugs is not so much that they're bad for you, and they are bad for you, as you just pointed out. The bigger problem is that they're illegal drugs, and that's what drives up the cost. That's why all the criminals get involved. That's why people are getting shot over it. You don't see people getting shot over alcohol or tobacco because, you know, they're legalized. It's the making them illegal that makes it bad in the first place. And then following up on the other part of your question, it's no defense that you drank yourself silly. I mean, if you chose to do that, then, you know, I hope you don't do it, and my heart goes out to you if you do, but you really have no claim on the state to do that. That goes back to what I was saying toward the beginning of the show. One thing I'm really pushing for is the separation of society and state. Have a separate organization called society with its own constitution, but society does not have the coercive power of taxation. So if there are people who by misfortune, whether it's by their own cause or by just whatever it may be, whatever the cause is, for old people, for poor people, society would step in and help them as best they could. So that's how I would combat that. It wouldn't be the state that would help these people. It would be a voluntary society using voluntarily contributed funds. So there's two sides. Get rid of the war on drugs. It's insane. And separate society and state, so that society can take care of the people who need help.
Yeah, well, I'm still there with you in the sense of you do drugs, then you're going to get the consequences. I'm not going to pay for your bad choices with drugs.
That's right. You know, and if you're driving drunk and you crash into somebody, you got to pay for the damage. If you kill somebody, you're a murderer. That's all there is to it.
Well, I see the libertarian perspective is real simple. When you harm somebody, that's when you're to be held to account.
Correct. No victim, no crime. I said it earlier, and I'll say it again.
Right.
I'm a man of principles. That's one nice thing about when I'm running for governor. People can hit me with a brand new question that I've never heard before, and I have my principles. No victim, no crime. It's your life. You live it your way as long as you respect the rights and property of others. And I keep falling back on that.
Yeah, so would you be tough on crimes where people were actually hurt?
Yep.
Well,
that's what government should do.
We talked about, you know, illegal drugs, things of that nature. What about the illegal immigrants that are coming into the United States? Would you support amnesty, or what's your view on that?
Well, first of all, speaking as a candidate for governor of Pennsylvania, I think the people in New Jersey should be allowed to come into Pennsylvania freely. And the same thing with people over there in Robert over there in Ohio. I think we should keep the borders open. Generally, that would be my stand. Now, I'm not running for president of the United States, and I don't think that I would want to. I'm really a state guy. I've studied the Constitution, and I do state issues. But in terms of immigration, all five of my grandparents, I have five grandparents, my grandmother married twice, all five of them came over from the old country in steerage, and they came here to work. And if people are coming here seeking a better life, then by all means, I think we should let them in. But, again, I have no authority over that.
So
you mentioned.
Are you? Well, you talk, wait a minute. I'll explore this a little bit more. Because yeah, I mean, you do, in, you know, directly don't have any purview of it, correct? But you know, the stance of what you know could affect you know nationally definitely has some importance you know to voters. So, am I hearing right where I'm saying that you believe in open borders on the national level, like from illegal immigrants coming in?
I do, but I also believe in controlling. I believe in controlling the borders. I did run for Congress back in 2000, and my stand then, I could tell you my approach to it, is that any individual in America could sponsor anybody to come into the country, and you could sponsor any one person. And once they get here, you're the one responsible for them. And until they get on their feet as a taxpaying, earning, wage-earning, upstanding person, then you can only do one. So, and of course, once they're on their, once they're here and quote-unquote assimilated, well, then you can bring another one over. What that would do is that would control immigration, by, and we wouldn't have the floodgates open. We wouldn't be getting criminals in here and things like that. But it wouldn't be the government that would be controlling it. It would be we, the people, who would be controlling it. And that's the way I would come at it. I would like to see something more under our control, not under government control. And you could always take your right to bring somebody into the country, and you could pool that. You could go give it to Amnesty International and let them bring people in. So that's generally how I would approach it. And, again, it's not my purvey. I think that America would – our strength is our immigrant population, and I think we really need to support that and not jail them.
If I might –
go for it.
A couple of points. First of all, just to finish with the illegal argument to, before we get back to something else. First, it isn't the purview of the states. That is one of the enumerated things that's given to the federal government to control
true,
right. the borders. And
as I said,
right
I had nothing
now,
to do with it.
There are many people who are coming through legally under exactly the kind of situation that Karen is describing.
Wait a minute. What's that, Kelly?
Actually,
the correction,
the way it was set up is that the states will sponsor an immigrant, and then they become a citizen of the states. The federal government took over that job. Yeah, it's fascinating. Like somebody should
yeah, with
it
the 14th Amendment. So you know about state citizenship and sovereignty.
Yeah, back in the 20s, when my grandmother came over, who was the latest immigrant to come to this country, my family, she had to be sponsored by somebody who was a citizen who guaranteed her, guaranteed the government, said she's going to have a job, she's going to have a place to stay. She will not break any laws. If she does, I'm liable. I'm liable for the fines. I can go to prison in her stead. So people were really careful to make certain that they didn't bring over anyone unless they were really serious about becoming Americans. And when they got here, they were really careful to make sure that those people did what they were supposed to do. They helped them. And there was a community, a voluntary community, that did this. Now, I know quite a few legal immigrants who've chosen to come and become Americans, and I don't have any problem with the fact that they're going through all of these hoops. Most of them know the Constitution as well or better than Ken or Kelly. I mean, seriously, they study this stuff. They love America. The problem with illegals is a different matter, and sanctuary cities and sanctuary states are just as illegal as what Obama's doing on the southern border right now. But I want to take issue with the idea of minding your own business. I think that's a great thing for the government. I think
yes.
it's fine for people to be interested in what their neighbors, friends, coworkers are doing. It's fine to have an opinion about it. It's fine to express that opinion. And unless you're hitting them over the head and making them stop or making them do something, you haven't committed any crime. The idea that we can't judge is foolish. In fact, it was the society's power to voluntarily judge somebody who was a drunkard or a wife beater or a deadbeat, or a cheat, as no good, that made those people unable to get around and do those things. The shame of it, that thing that's missing from today's society, it was there and it was palpable. And if you were one of those people, you really couldn't hold your head up anywhere, and nobody would really do any business with you unless you cleaned up your act and they didn't force it on you. You just wouldn't get a job, or if you did, it wouldn't be a good one. And none of the women would speak to you. And if you tried to speak to one of the women, their brother would probably punch you in the nose. So I want to make it clear that libertarians may have a view, that, and I'm not, you know, saying I'm an expert in this or speaking for them, that people have the right to do what they want and no one can say anything. Yeah, people can say something. That's part of your liberty, too. Free speech means that, and I get this all the time, I would say, I don't know, a third of the people out there who are in the liberty movement think I am too darn radical. And a third of them are convinced I am not radical enough, not nearly. And a third of them think I'm just right. And, you know, it's probably going to be the same with anybody who's taking a stand. Every person who comes on this show, Kelly gets great responses and maybe some that aren't quite so great. Bob, of course, always gets great responses and nothing but. And I know James with Overpasses. I follow Overpasses. This is a tremendous group. And there are people who think it's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and there are others who have accused Overpasses of doing horrendous things and being just horrible people. And it's their right to say that as long as they're not actually doing anything to the Overpasses members in exercise of their free speech. And it's absolutely wrong, and this has happened, where government officials, law enforcement, has come up and said, no, you can't hold a sign up and let people read it. Well, that's illegal. You can't videotape me arresting you.
Go ahead and,
how dare you?
Right. Let's
we've
ahead
actually
and,
done that.
James. First, I want to ask a question before I bring it over to you, James. And I do see that there's only 24 minutes, believe it or not, left of the live time of the show. And so we may be going into what we call the extended version of the show, which, of course, if you're listening live at midnight Eastern time, you'll be booted off. So if you'd like to listen into the show or like to chime in, do so by calling us at 347-945-7428. And that's 347-945-7428. Call in the next 20 minutes if you'd like to hear the extended version of the show, which, of course, will be available in the archives after the show ends. And so one of the things I've noticed, and I want to ask this to everyone, starting with you, James, is that, you know, I'm seeing, at least in my communities around where I live, you know, Spanish signs, you know, popping up all over the place. Next year they're going to be having my daughter in school, and she goes to a private school, private Catholic school, where next year she's going to start to learn Spanish. Now, they're not offering any other language like Latin, which, in my opinion, with what she says she wants to do with you know, her life, when she wants to pursue, Latin would be a better fit for her to take. But they're not even offering. That's the problem I have, is they're having kids take Spanish in class, but they're not offering for any other language, such as I said, Latin. Do you folks, do you guys think that perhaps we're making it, by, you know, by changing all these signs and, you know, with Spanish in there, and even on our telephones now, you know, you have to push another just to get English. Do you think they're accommodating too much for the, I would say, not just the, you know, well, mainly the illegal immigrants and those who are flooding, you know, coming in, especially from the Spanish-speaking country? James?
Well, I was going to jump in there and jump first. This is Ken. And I would say that...
Yeah, go ahead, Ken, and then James.
The business...
So we've heard
yeah,
from James
the
last, well, I want to bring it back in, but go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, I want to jump in there and say it's a private matter. The businesses are seeing that there's a lot of people in who speak Spanish, so they're catering to that market so they can get a lot of the Spanish business. Now, I live just outside of Philadelphia, and in northeast Philadelphia, in my neighborhood, there's a very large Ukrainian contingent. So there are a lot of Ukrainian signs around here. You go into a store, and everything will be labeled in English and in Ukrainian. And in northeast Philadelphia, there's a large Russian population, and it's the same thing up there. So it's a question of whether or not the business wants to cater to that market and to actually drum up business. And I think it's a clever way of doing it. I certainly would not step in as say the government should stop that or foster that.
No,
it's up to the individual company.
I think there should be – well, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that, you know, it used to be where, you know, you come to America, you got to learn the language, learn the culture. And my concern is we're becoming a multicultural nation. When multiculturalism comes into a nation, then we've seen throughout history what multiculturalism does in splitting and dividing a nation. You know, the United States is no longer, or at least is quickly becoming no longer, the melting pot anymore, where you came in, you became an American. Now we have, you know, it's more like a salad bowl, where you have your different communities all spread out, and, you know, there's not as much of a push, you know, to learn what some would think, some should think, or
I disagree.
Becoming the,
I disagree because the neighborhood that my parents grew up in, my mom's neighborhood, was 100% Polish. My baptismal certificate is written completely in Polish. Everybody there is in Polish. Everybody spoke Polish there. And it's the same thing with the neighborhood that we moved into. My father was Ukrainian, so it was a Ukrainian neighborhood. People spoke Ukrainian there. I mean, and I'm talking now back in the 50s and 60s when I was a kid. So this is not something new. It's always been that way. And little by little, it's the kids who wind up getting assimilated. The first generation, yeah, they're a little bit clicky, but the kids are the ones who spread out. So it's always been that way, and it'll always be that way.
And I don't disagree with that, but now, you know, we're seeing it where even the youngsters, I mean, I'm speaking, you know, maybe in my area, I live in Ohio, but what I'm seeing is that even the youngsters, you know, where you'll hear them talking and whatever, and around here mostly it's Spanish, you know, talking that and not speaking English, things of that nature. And also, I want to also address is, as I said, you know, my daughter's in school and they're offering, you know, I mean, if they were offering other languages, you know, such as Latin, I probably wouldn't be as much of a red flag for me. But since they're only offering one language for them to take, you know, I see a problem in that.
Homeschool. You can homeschool them.
Well, no, there's another answer. Folks, you've given them the answer, but you're all not quite seeing what the history is, perhaps. Maybe I'm wrong. Ken is absolutely right, and there were foreign language newspapers, theater, films, political speeches, everything in Polish or in Ukrainian or in Yiddish or in Italian or in German, and it wasn't just society that got the children to conform. What it was the schools. And the schools were under local control, and the people who were already established in the community who spoke English and who had a vested interest in children being good, productive citizens who knew how to do math and knew the great classics and knew understood how politics actually was supposed to work in this country and needed to know basics of trade or home economics or whatever it is, they made certain they learned it. And if you look at any textbook from a century ago, the stuff that these kids knew in fifth grade would make, I mean, you've seen that show, Are You Smarter Than a Fifth Grader? Well, those fifth graders were smarter than graduate students. And my grandfather, who was of an immigrant father from Russia, who had to quit school in the sixth grade when his father died because he was a big boy and they needed another hand on the farm because, you know, the work had to get done. He had a lot of brothers and sisters who needed to be taken care of, and he was the oldest. He always regretted that he didn't have education, as he put it, because he only went to the sixth grade. This is a man who successfully ran his own business, who was a civic leader in Atlantic City, who – that's where he lived – who read three newspapers a day, followed stories – had an intelligent, informed opinion about just about anything, would be willing to anyone in a discussion about it in detail, and who could do complex percents, compound percents in his head. That was with a sixth grade education. Today, the schools are being uniform, and they're being directed on a level from, I don't know if it's the federal government or some nefarious organization run by Bill Ayers and the rest of the former Weather Underground, who are now, you know, pretty much in charge of the educational system in this country. But, you know, here's a question for you, Ken. Let's bring it back to reality. Common Core, we've been talking about that. In Pennsylvania, they say, oh, it's not a federal program. We had Peg Luxick on a month or two ago, and you know Peg very well.
Uh-huh. And I know Peg. Yeah, I ran against her in 1998.
Well, that would have been finally not the choice of the lesser of two evils, but two decent people who would have both done a great job.
Thank
but
you.
what she was explaining to us was that Pennsylvania Core is word for word what Common Core is, that the so-called National Association of Governors is really a private organization, that this is being sponsored by the Federal Department of Education and by Bill Gates' big money, and the legislature has yet to address this issue, nor have most of the local school districts, although one or two states has now decided to opt out. I believe it might be Indiana. I'm not certain of that. As governor, what could you and would you do to restore local control, local choice to the local communities who want to educate their own children in a good way?
Well, as I already mentioned, I would...
After you answer this question, I do want to bring James in. We haven't heard from James for a while, and I do like to try to give, you know, as equal time as I can here on the show. So, James, any comments or questions you have next, and then go ahead, Ken.
Okay. Well, first of all, I'm against Common Core. I'm against any large-scale trying to come in here and do a one-size-fits-none, pushing down from a larger organization how local education should happen. I want local control of the schools. And as I said earlier in the show, that I want parents to decide what their kids get taught. They should be able to choose any government school, including charter schools, and they could focus on any of these things. Now, back in 1998, I ran for governor the first time, and Peg Luksic also ran that year. She was the Constitution Party candidate. I was the Libertarian. And back then, it was outcomes-based education, which is the same thing that we have now. I mean, it's just like Common Core. They keep trying to repackage it, keep trying to push it down our throats. Now, as governor, I have some amount of control over the Board of Education, who's on that board. And I tell you, the first person I would like to appoint to head up the Pennsylvania Board of Education would be Peg Luksic.
A good choice.
Thank you. She's great.
Not just because I like her.
She does speak on it. Well,
but
she and I disagree on some things.
Program. That's okay. She's like you, an honest person with a ton of information and principles. You know,
yes,
if you would do nothing more as governor than to appoint people across the board who had principles and allow them to fill the bureaucracy that we have, and that some parts are probably necessary. Well, certainly some parts are necessary, but if you have bosses at the top who aren't rotten, you know, they say the fish rots from the top, we wouldn't have what we have now where pretty much everybody above first level supervisors everywhere in government is pretty bad.
You know, I've had people point that out to me before, that I'd be able to do so much of the appointing, but a lot of the appointments have to be approved by the state legislature. And I just laugh and say, well, there's going to be a lot of places that are going to go without anybody leading that organization, and we'll be able to shut down that part of the government and save taxpayers money. But we're going to go over to James. James, you going to sound off on this one? James, are you out there?
Yeah, I am out here.
Are you there,
phone
James?
Has been yes, I am. My phone has been breaking up very badly today for some reason. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay. Well, one question I had, and this is off the topic of where we've been so far, is, you know, but you know, as we've all seen, there's been a lot of voter fraud over at least the last two elections, but it's been going on for quite some time, and it seems to be increasing with our use of foreign electronic voting machines. You know, to prevent that in the state of Pennsylvania as governor, what would you do to address that problem?
Well, is the ideal solution, I would like to see voter verifiable voting techniques where you go in and vote and you get a receipt which says how you voted, and that way if there's ever a recount, that's what's counted, is that receipt, not what's on the voting machine. But the reality in Pennsylvania is that each county can decide for themselves what kind of voting machine that they're going to use. My county uses an electronic Diebold machine. Philadelphia, up until recently, used to use those big old fancy lever machines. There are other counties that use the punch cards. So right now it's a hodgepodge in Pennsylvania. And I'm not sure that that's a bad thing, because I'm more in favor of local control versus centralized control. But whatever changes would have to happen would have to go through the legislature. So if I were going to use the bully pulpit of the governorship, I would go for a voter verifiable paper ballot. You could vote electronically, but what really matters, your vote actually goes, you get a receipt and it goes into a box, and that box is what's counted in case there's any disputes. Good
okay,
question.
Here, I want to throw something out about that. Okay.
Go
well,
for it.
One, if you, and there has been problems with voter receipts, but when you take your receipt out of the voting building, some people will go give you $50 for that receipt, proof that you voted for their candidate. So there are some problems with that. I like your idea of putting the receipts in a separate box. Now, who would that go to? I would propose you get that to a grand jury. The electronic election machines are point-blank frightening. We've had Jim Condon on the show.
I agree. I agree completely. I'm an information technology guy. I've been a programmer since I was in high school. And I tell you, I put more back doors into systems than I would probably admit. But you're right. I fear electronic voting machines, and I'm terrified by Internet voting.
Yeah, so with the box going, you know, the ticket goes, they can't take it out of the building for getting paid, but the ticket goes into a locked box that only goes into the hands of the grand jury. They have their own subpoena power, so immediately they could just start grabbing a couple boxes and compare them to what the state results say, because there have been, I don't want to go into this, but it's more frightening than I ever imagined.
Yep. No, that's it. That's why you put voter verifiable. It's that any recount or any challenge is based on that receipt that goes in the box.
Yeah. Well, I got another question for you. Now we're talking about voting and getting yourself in office. There is this interesting thing about libertarians that I find fascinating. You know, some of the libertarians will say, well, yeah, I'm a recovering Democrat. Or another libertarian will say, I'm a recovering Republican. And I haven't told you whether I am or I'm not a libertarian, by the way. Just seeing how much fun I can have with this. All right. Here's the challenges of getting votes, and I want to know how you're going to address this, because I'm still puzzled about the libertarians with this. We have you got Democrats, and they hate guns. Not all of them, of course. There's some that think they hate guns. The libertarians, oh, Constitution's talking about it. Yeah, you should have your gun. And then you got the same Democrats saying, well, I love gay marriage, and I'm pro-choice. On the other hand, you've got Republicans, or maybe recovering Republicans, who are like, I love the Second Amendment. Oh, I really like the libertarians. But you guys, I'm sorry, you just like big-time gay marriage supporters. And so you have this, you know, you've got the left, you've got the environmentalists on the right with the Republicans, you've got landowners. You have all these things that people could take either way, and they're not going to come into the party. And how are you, in a sense, reconciling this to attract large numbers to vote for you?
I have two answers to that. Let me do the first one is the theoretical answer. And I started on this before, but let me go through it in detail. People on the left, and I know I'm painting with a broad brush here, people on the left, generally speaking, are in favor of personal freedoms, but they're a bit against economic freedoms. So they like high taxes, but they're in favor of gay marriage and decriminalizing drugs and things like that. People on the right are generally in favor of economic freedom, but not in favor of personal freedom. So they want lower regulations, but they'll be in your bedroom telling you what to do. We libertarians, we believe in personal freedom and economic freedom. We believe in freedom all the time. So we pull the vote of those Democrats who agree with us on personal freedoms, and we pull the votes of those Republicans who agree with us on economic freedoms. But if you have a Republican who agrees, of course, on the economic freedoms and some of the personal freedoms, well, they've got nowhere else to go. And if you have people on the left who certainly they agree with us on personal freedoms, but also some economic freedoms, well, they've got nowhere else to go. So they're the people who are closer to the center on the left and right. They're the ones who will be voting for libertarians. Of course, the hardcores, they're not going to vote for us at all, and I don't even bother wasting my time talking to a lot of them. As soon as I realize who they are, it's like, okay, listen, don't vote for me. I'm not going to be doing what you want me to do. But
well,
those people who are more
That was an absolutely neat flip of
in both parties, there are no place for these people to go.
That's right. That's right. We libertarians, we're the common denominator. We're the best of both worlds. We believe in personal freedom and economic freedom. So
wow.
Now that's a theoretical answer. Let me give you the practical answer. There are 8 million registered voters in Pennsylvania. But because of the two old parties, they have disenfranchised the voters such that they're only expecting a turnout of maybe 30%, 35% this year. So that means that fewer than 3 million people are going to vote in this election. So in a competitive three-way race, fewer than 1 million votes are going to win it. So all I need to do is attract the vote of 1 out of 8 voting-age Pennsylvanians, and I've won. The actual number is like 11.7%, so it's a little better than 1 out of 8. So if I'm in a room talking to – if there are 8 people in the room and 7 of them are laughing at me and one says, Ken, they're great ideas, that's all I need. So there's the practical side. Just because the two old parties have disenfranchised and disillusioned all the voters.
Oh, yeah. Well, we had a terrible turnout in our June 5th primary.
Yeah, same thing with us here in Pennsylvania.
Terrible low turnout. Yep. It's just like, really? I don't even want to go there. I had a friend, I ran into him, and he goes, I said, hey, Bill, how you doing, blah, blah, blah. Oh, good question. Did you vote? No. Don't want to hear any political thing until November. You cannot.
Hmm.
You didn't vote. You cannot, bitch. But I wanted to throw out something to you, if I may.
Go for
it. You know, Robert, you have my permission to give Ken here my phone number. What would you think about? I mean, this is the key thing about libertarians. They love the Constitution. Okay. And by the way, you mentioned we libertarians. So did you guess I'm a libertarian by now?
With your knowledge of the law, that's certainly enough. Anybody who knows the law has to be a libertarian.
Well, you get there quick. Yeah, I was in Nashville 2012 in 2 state conventions here in California. Anyway, I wanted to ask, constitutional challenge is something I've come up with, and we can talk more about it. I really liken it to a job interview, if you will. Okay?
Yeah.
Most politicians say, oh, I love the Constitution, really prove it. I mean, you know, it's kind of like this story of, a hospital puts an ad in the paper wanting a doctor. The guy shows up. Oh, you know about medicine? Oh, medicine's a really good idea. Oh, yeah, I really like medicine. And hospitals. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me ask you. I mean, this is what politicians do when they talk about the Constitution. They don't know diddly squat. It's kind of talk they give. And the next time the interviewer says, well, what do you know about brain surgery? Oh, I like helping people. And people with brains, yeah, uh-huh. Okay, end of interview. But that's what these politicians do. And so I've developed a system, if you will. It's a point system. It is a literal job interview. We would need someone like you who's willing to, particularly you're fond of and study the Pennsylvania Constitution, and we find another candidate, maybe the Republican or the Democrat, and you have some group put it on, and you pass your job interview with a point system. Is that something you're interested in?
I would love to hear about it, but, I found that you don't even have to go that far. Because my first race, I had my Pennsylvania Constitution with me. I was running for state rep. And I asked the Republican, I said, have you read this? And she's like, well, I've skimmed it. And I asked the Democrat, have you read this? He's like, no. And I says, you've sworn an oath to uphold this. How could you do this? And I just did it in the last race, too. Somebody's calling for a jobs program. And the Democrat said, I'll get you a jobs program. The Republican said, I'll get you a jobs program. And I said, excuse me, where does it say in the Constitution that you can provide jobs programs? And I handed the Constitution. I said, can you show me? And the Democrat turns away, and I hand it to the Republican. Here, can you show me? She's like, looks the other way. They don't know. See, your point system may be good for the citizen who's trying to decide if a given candidate is good, but in a debate situation, I just ask, have you read it? And the answer is no. If they say yes and they say something against the Constitution, I say, well, gee, where is that in the Constitution? So I just embarrass them in public.
Well,
it's so easy
to
do.
Strategy.
So your point system, is it a complicated thing? Can you sum it up, or is it something we'll have to take offline?
Oh, well, it's basically a point system, like a job interview. I mean, the reason why I'm going after this is because the Tea Party people, when they see how much libertarians love the Constitution, they might be willing to avoid their rhino representatives who only say they know the Constitution.
I'm seeing that. I'm doing a lot of the Tea Party and the 912ers. In fact, tomorrow night I'm going to be in Lewistown, the Mifflin County Tea Party 912 organization. So, and they're all very annoyed with Governor Corbett, very annoyed because he's just not representing even Republican ideals, let alone ideals.
Well, yeah, if we could go a little further with this, if you invite the governor and he doesn't show up, what's it say? He doesn't care about the Constitution. You know, if he shows up and you get like 100 and plus bonus points out of 100, you get 120 points, and this guy only gets 30, that's such egg on the face, and he will be exposed. And with the issues these days, it'll go everywhere.
Yep.
So it's just it's a tool, if you will. And it's too bad.
I hear you.
It's too bad that the other guy we had on the, I can't remember his name right now, we really liked him, though. He couldn't get enough to be a candidate. But the both of you would have been fun to have do this job interview.
Oh, yeah. Yep, it's a lot of fun. You know, when I ran in 2002, I had always had the Constitution with me, and I had a special version where you open up the inside cover, and it would be one that the other candidates could use, because in the front it said in big letters, they can do what they want. And I would, every time they suggest something unconstitutional, I just hold up my Constitution.
Wow. Well, Russia had a constitution. China and Cuba, Weimar Republic.
Well, Kelly, speaking of doing what you want, I'm going to do what I want right now. And what I want right now is to bring on one of our other panelists, our beloved Cindy Todd. Thank you very much, Cindy, for coming to the show. How are you?
I'm so glad you get what you want on this show. I'm doing great. I've been enjoying the conversation, but I have to admit, I'm about to make a comment, but you'll have to forgive me if you guys have already covered these points because my computer fan is busted, and I'm having to turn it off and on and off and on, you know, to let it cool down. And so I may have missed some things.
Sounds like my love light. No, I'm just kidding. Go ahead.
No, it isn't.
Bard's Logic After Dark. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. That's right. We are in After Dark, and you didn't give anybody the notice on that, but I guess that's okay. We didn't have a lot in chat tonight, and I don't understand. I didn't understand if maybe my computer was messing up or what, but anyway. Let me just say this. You've seen some folks.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Ken, for being on. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you, Cindy. It's a pleasure to be here. It's good to hear your voice. Good to have a woman's point of view for a change.
Well, you're going to get it, kiddo.
Woo-hoo. Go for it.
And you're going to get a conservative woman's viewpoint. I am a registered Republican, but the Republicans don't speak for me anymore. I don't give money to the Republican Party anymore in general. I do give money to individual candidates. And I've made that decision because I've decided that you just really have to get to know candidates before you give them your money, because anybody can say that they agree with you or they say they want to represent you and your viewpoint. But that doesn't mean that when they get to Washington or State House that that's what they're going to do. And so I really am proud of Robert, how he is having all these candidates on here so that people will get a chance to vet them and really get to know them a little more deeply. And since this show is a, you know, 2 or 3 hour show, we do get to hear a lot more than like at a town hall thing where you just kind of, you're limited as to, you know, what you can talk about. But anyway, I have to differ with you on a couple of issues, and that's normal because the libertarians are a little more liberal for me than what I like. But I do have to say you have some really good ideas, and you made me think deeply about some issues. And particularly, now I'm trying to think that there was one that you had just the perfect answer, and now I can't remember what subject that was.
Was that the abortion issue? Because I was really impressed with that.
No, I do like his ideas, though, on how to reduce abortions, giving legal status, being able to...
prenatal adoption.
Yeah, prenatal adoption.
Right.
I think that's a great idea. And
thank you.
I like that. But I don't think you go quite far enough, and this is why. I think you'll all agree with me, everybody on here, that we can't go lawless in our society. Anarchists just aren't going to work.
Correct.
There is too much chaos in that kind of a situation. But the laws that we create should be laws that protect innocent life. That means innocent physical life, innocent financial life, and innocent mental life. And our laws should be subject to a standard. Well, I believe that our forefathers gave us a standard when they said that among our liberties that were given to us by God was life. And when you take a look at the life in the womb and you just assign it a non-person status, you have gone against not only God's law, but scientific law. Because science, to all the definitions of science, tell us that what is inside of a woman is a human live human being, okay?
Yep.
Why that
46
live
chromosomes.
Human being?
I says you're right. 46 chromosomes, and that defines
right.
human.
Exactly. So why that life is not protected by law, just the same as yours and mine, who are outside of the womb, I cannot fathom. And I think that we need to go farther. And if we have to do it on a state level, fine. But I really think it should be done on the federal level because life is mentioned in the Constitution, well, the preamble. And and so I think it ought to be addressed, and there ought to be a definition of human life and that the life inside of a womb should be protected by law in some fashion. Now, this I understand that's our problem, that people don't want to separate the two lives, women who want to continue their life the way they are living it without a baby want to say, well, that's part of me, and I have the right to say what's going to happen to me. But as we just now established, it's a separate human being, and it ought to be protected by law. So I think that we need a... oh, gosh, now I forgot what the name of the law is. That Oh, crap. Anyway, there is a law. There is an amendment or a definition of human life amendment that's out there. But anyway, that's my thought on.
Well, I have a couple of thoughts on that. The first one is that it is not a federal issue. It has always been the state's issue to take care of defending the individual life of people. And the second thing is I was raised Roman Catholic, so I have a very strong pro-life background. But I've seen the laws, especially here in Pennsylvania. I'm not sure what state you're in, but Pennsylvania used to have very, very strict abortion laws. And what that did was that tended to injure more women than it did good. And we're not going to go back to that really quick. But what I'd like to see is several steps heading in that direction. We do it one step at a time. We can't just immediately ban all abortions for all reasons. Instead, my approach of a prenatal adoption will save a great number of babies. And that is something that's politically doable right now in the short term, whereas going whole hog for just banning abortions, whether it's a federal or even a state initiative, politically it's not viable. It's not going to be able to pass. But what's going to happen is we can now take the first step and save a large number of these babies, but we could save perfection for the governor who comes after me. So that's my approach to the whole thing.
Well,
I'm not gonna
I know, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't do something like that to try to reduce abortion as right now. But what I'm saying is we need to define the child inside the womb as an independent person, because
mm-hmm.
that's the only way we're going to put them on the same level. If murder is wrong for me to murder my husband or my neighbor, then why is it not wrong to murder a baby in the womb? That's my point.
Well,
it is still a human life.
Well, I want to ask Ken some questions that I think might clarify some things here, which points I've been trying to make for quite some time. Mm-hmm. Ken, why is it the Founding Fathers didn't put into the federal Constitution don't kill, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't abort, and don't do gay marriage, and don't steal? Why didn't they not put that into the federal Constitution? Do you have any idea?
Well, generally speaking, the states did do that. It's in the 9th and 10th Amendments, saying that those things are reserved to the states specifically.
Right, but
now,
Why didn't they get specific about things in the federal Constitution, whereas states had already had their own laws? Why is the feds didn't clarify things right there to get this debate over with before it even got started?
Well, because the enumeration of certain rights does not disparage the existence of others. I mean, the minute you put – and one of the Founding Fathers said that if you start putting things in there, they're going to say, well, these are the only ones you have. I think Benjamin Rush was one of the signers of the Declaration. He was a doctor, and he wanted to have medical freedom put into the Constitution, because he said if you didn't put it in there, there'll come a day when doctors are going to only be able to practice at the whim of the state. And that was very prophetic, but –
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Maybe they should have been put in there. I couldn't tell you why they didn't put the whole bunch in there.
Well, the reason why I've made this point several times in the show is that this number one, the states, of course, started in 1776. They created the federal government.
Yep.
Only had certain powers, but the states already had all sorts of laws. And in fact, Pennsylvania in like 1760 outlawed slavery, and King George says, "No, you're gonna have the slave trade." But they already had all sorts of different laws, you know, murder, theft, adultery, whatever. They already had them within the states, but they did not put them in the federal Constitution. And I believe the reason why they did that, arguably, is that once you open the door to the federal government in your own personal social life, you have just
mm-hmm.
given the federal government a blank check to grow to infinity. To see. The feds can tell you that your house must be, instead of pink, it's got to be green.
Oh, because
the
children like it that way.
So the federal government is in my social business if I want to murder my husband and they won't let me?
The federal government, it's handled by the state. Murder crimes are handled by the state.
There's not
Cindy,
a federal law against murder?
Correct, there is not. Cindy, you're taking it and you're making it an us versus them situation, because it's not murder per se. You could also look at it as, what do we do with the mess? Now, what if I have a born child and I don't want the child? I can abandon that child. I can give it to somebody else. I could walk away from it, and then somebody else can step in and take care of it. If nobody decides to take care of that child, it's a cruel, harsh world out there. And it's a shame, and I would never want to see that happen. But if nobody wants to take care of a child, then the child is going to die. It is not murder. It's abandonment.
That's not
so,
I'm sorry, but there are 3-year waiting lists for people who want to adopt children. That isn't going to happen.
I know. See, and that's why we need the prenatal adoption, because the love is out there. What we need to do is just change that law just a little bit, and we can satisfy that waiting list. And so it's only a question of what do we do with the mess? Well, people want that mess. I know babies aren't a mess. I shouldn't call them a mess, but you get the idea. It's not murder. It's the law stopping loving parents from getting a baby. The laws are doing that. It's not a law allowing abortion. It's a law stopping adoptions. That's what the problem is. You can't look at it as murder because that's divisive and it chases people away. You want to bring people together. You want to save these babies. And the best way to do that is to change the law to grease the skids to allow it to happen.
Well, we'll just have to disagree. I mean, we'll have to agree to disagree on that one because...
You don't
want to
save babies? You do want to save babies.
I do want to do that. It'll give legal recognition
to the children.
Wait, folks, I'm going to interject here.
Okay. What I think we're talking about here is, I think in her perspective, that killing a baby is murder, and no one can change her perspective. That's how she feels about it, or that's how she thinks about it. You know, so that's her right to think that. Now, some would say, well, because you call it murder, it's divisive, whichever way you want to say it. But the fact of the matter is there, and it's not just Cindy. There are many of those who contend that whether you're killing someone outside of the womb or you're killing someone inside of the womb, it's both murder. And I guess the question is how can you differentiate, killing someone inside the womb and killing someone outside the womb and both of them not being murder if both of them's a human life? And James, I want to bring him in real quick. And then, James, did you want to make a comment on that perhaps? You can, and then we've got Dan we can bring in, too. Go ahead, James. You still have the
I think we might have lost James.
He's still on the switch.
I'm sorry, Robert. James, I stepped out of the room to get a refill and I had to hit mute.
that's okay.
Personally, I feel and think that at some point we really should ban abortion for convenience. Now, if the child is going to die, and I'm not talking a maybe, a speculative thing to try to get federal money because you're Planned Parenthood and you're going to tell the woman that the child is going to die, not that type of thing, where it's a medical obvious thing where, a trained professional doctor says that this child will not live, it has no chance of living, and to continue to carry it will, bring you grievous harm or death. That's an entirely separate circumstance, and I can understand something at that point. However, the abortion for convenience, and that's what they really are for the vast majority. It's because somebody was irresponsible, and because they were irresponsible and didn't choose to use birth control, they chose instead to be irresponsible, bring a life into the world, and then to avoid the consequences of their irresponsibility, choose to murder somebody. And if that's the case, with that being the measure, why isn't it legal to walk up to somebody that was driving slow in front of you and shoot them in the face? Because you were irresponsible and didn't leave your home in time to get to wherever your destination was, and you were late, but nevertheless, because of your irresponsibility, another life brought about you inconvenience. Now, that's essentially the same mentality that these people have to say, it's my right for an abortion. Well, no more is it their right for an abortion. Is it my right to go up and shoot a slow driver in the face because they made me late for my destination? With that being the measure, there has to be some sort of middle ground in the meantime, because you will never get it banned outright until you return that responsibility to the average person, until personal responsibility becomes American again. And right now, in this time in our society, Americans are extraordinarily irresponsible. Our founding fathers would be ashamed of us. And so, you know, as much as I personally wish that they would just outright ban it, I also understand the political reality of it. And an outright ban of abortion on demand just simply won't happen. And I think that his middle ground approach to it could begin to move us back toward that personal responsibility. There is no excuse for not using birth control in 2014. I mean, good grief, back in the 90s, when I was in my 20s and married, they have a product called Encare, which is still on the market today. Well, I can promise you that from my very virile 20s and having had one daughter, so I know everything functions, that this product works every bit as good as the pill. And it's an insertable thing. You don't have to have the discomfort of a condom. So the excuse that, well, birth control is inconvenient. No, I can promise you it's not, and that's from personal experience. So that excuse is null and void. And
it is Bart's logic after dark, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Yes.
I took advantage of that, to be quite frank there, Robert. like I said, I agree with his middle-of-the-road approach in that, because it also creates an opportunity for people to have children that cannot get them right now because adoption laws are so restrictive right now. They really are. They need to be simplified. If you have no reason that
too.
You can't raise a child, then adoption should just be a matter of signing a piece of paper that you're going to take responsibility for that child.
That's right. And
can I say something before James gets off? James, I wanted to tell you happy birthday.
Wait a minute. You know, go ahead, James. I'm just kidding. Go ahead. Never
I just
mind.
Wanted to say happy birthday to Overpasses, to James. We're coming up on the first anniversary, right?
Yes, we are, June 13th.
And I wish I could be somewhere where there was a rally, but I'm stuck out here in the middle of a big old huge cattle ranch in Texas, and there's nothing anywhere near me.
Yeah, just get every flag you have in the house and put them outdoors somewhere where anybody driving by can see them.
Well, the cows will see them, I guess.
You could paint Gadsden flags on the cows, and then NSA satellites would see them.
There you go.
And they're watching all that flatulence anyway, so we'll put the flag right there back there at the end of the cow where every time they fart, the flag went away.
Whoa. Good. That puts a lot of methane into the Vietnam. I'm not going to go there. I'm just
global warming.
Yeah, you know what? It does.
Yeah, I'm
you
not going
to
have to buy a lot of subscribe to that. But.
Yeah, you'll have to buy a lot of carbon credits to offset that.
Sometimes I'm surprised at what I come out with. I'm sorry.
Actually, since you gave me that segue in there, Cindy, to all the listeners, I would like to ask that, you know, if you're not with Overpasses, on Saturday, get every flag, every patriotic flag you have in your house, and put them out Saturday. It's Flag Day. A lot of people don't even realize that's what the holiday is coming up Saturday. And, we need to stand up for our country. We need to show people that we're proud to be Americans. It's not the 4th of July. It's the day we celebrate our flag and everything that it stands for. And so this Saturday, I would like everybody across America, I don't care if you're you know, what political party you are, what any affiliation you have of any sort. If you have a flag, put it out there. Let the nation, let your neighbors see it. Let them know that you're proud to be an American.
James, I would suggest something much more radical than that. Now, I live in a small village here in Schuylkill County, in Schuylkill Township, and nobody even knows what Schuylkill means. It's a little river. But we have flags. They're out from the beginning of spring until the onset of cold weather, and we voluntarily, we've got problems with our local elected officials, and we're trying to get clean up corruption, but this is something we all agreed on, very patriotic people. However, I'm flying my flag upside down this Flag Day, and I don't care if it pisses people off, because this country is in distress, and that is an internationally recognized distress signal. I'm very concerned, and quite frankly, I have pride in America as the founders intended it. I have pride in the Constitution as it's written. I have pride in individuals.
All right, where did everybody go?
I'm still here, but Dan seems to have been beamed up somewhere.
Uh-oh.
You
know? He may have hit a button.
Yeah. Dan's call dropped. I just seen that Dan's call dropped. And normally what I used to do is try to do a three-way calling, but I've been trying to do that. The past couple times I've tried to do that lately, it has disconnected the show. So unfortunately, I'm not going to even make the attempt.
Oh.
Yeah, that happened last
week.
Well,
I know what happened. I know what happened to Dan. What happened was the microphone gods got him for violating the eighth deadly sin, which is hogging the microphone.
he wasn't hogging it this
time. That brings me to a question, but there is something, Ken, that you mentioned earlier about funding and spending and things of that nature. And it kind of surprised me that the problem, at least it sounded like the problem you had was spending money on NASA. How can you be a Star Trek fan and have any problems with spending money on NASA?
I used to be a real big NASA supporter until Challenger exploded. Because after that, Ronald Reagan, I was a Democrat back then. I used to believe in using your money for my ends. But Ronald Reagan, after the Challenger exploded, he said, get all the commercial payloads off the shuttle. It's only going to be government stuff. And at that point, there were only two major launchers besides the space shuttle. 10 years later, there were over 60, because all of a sudden now the commercial market was opening up. And as it turned out, NASA, by monopolizing space access, had set back commercial space dozens of years. Now, as much as Obama has done wrong, and I'm certainly not a fan of Obama, one thing he did right was when, years ago, he canceled George Bush's Constellation program, and he said, let's turn this over to private industry. And I don't know if you're following space exploration technology, SpaceX. They're currently going to and from the space station, taking cargo up and down, and they're doing it with an American rocket built by an American making money. Let me just finish this because what we've done is we've unleashed the American capitalist system. And the French with their Ariane rockets are shaking in their boots because they know the government can't compete. The Chinese are shaking in their boots with their Long March rocket because they know that they can't compete. And the reason why we're gonna take over space, because we've unleashed the private sector. And now the private sector, we have Orbital Science is going to and from the space station. SpaceX is going up there. Boeing's about to start doing it. Sierra Nevada, Blue Origins, all these private space companies. Who am I forgetting? Virgin Galactic? We have all these private space companies now that are going to take over space. Government's going to be left behind. So I'm a huge space supporter. I am not a NASA supporter.
I have to second
so
that.
We'll
and there's
the,
a, there's
we'll
one you actually
Mars
left
before,
out. I'll be
in our generation.
I'm sorry. One at a time, please.
I'm going to interject here. You guys know I rarely do this, but I'm definitely very passionate about space programs myself. So, and I do want to bring up something later. But I did have a question So it sounds like you may keep up with, you know that part of technology. Is that, so do you think that we'll ever either, A, make it back to the moon, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later, but, you know, we don't have much time left. And also, when the heck are we going to get on Mars? We were first slotted to be on Mars by 2016. How far back do you think we are on that now?
Well, I can actually answer those questions if you don't mind.
I
know the answers too, but go ahead.
Yeah, I follow private space programs avidly. I'm a huge fan of it. One of my biggest frustrations has been with NASA is the fact that they move so slowly that instead of having a viable space program, you know, we're stuck in low Earth orbit. We spend more money on science fiction than we do to actually getting, movies. We spend more on movies about what we could do in space than we actually do things in space, and it's extremely frustrating. I really thought that by now, you know, here I'm coming up on 47 years old, that we would actually have a colony on Mars. In regards to your colony on Mars question, there actually is a Mars One project right now that is making preparations. They're actually in colonist selection mode, the final cut, to actually create a permanent one-way trip. Now that's the key right there that a lot of people would balk at. It's a one-way trip to Mars, where you will then be a permanent settler there. Also, James Cameron, who did that extraordinary submarine voyage to the bottom of the Marianas Trench in that submarine that his company designed, is also teaming up with another billionaire, and I can't recall the name of the other person. But their plan is in the next 10 years to begin mining asteroids. Well, that's going to take people. They're not going to be able to do that entirely with robotic anything. It's going to take people up there to do that. And because the private sector, because of NASA's, bulky, they're the government. They're a government program. They're funded by the government. They move slowly because they're controlled by special interests. We've got SpaceX, I'm trying to remember all the players in it now, but we have got a very, very competitive space race right now. Right now it's just to go to the ISS, and that's great because it'll give them the foundation technology to do more. SpaceX just did a test landing on a reusable spacecraft that will land instead of, burning, like the shuttles did and the Apollo capsules did. But they also have their capsule as well, so they're not just going at it from a single angle. Space technology right now, because of the private sector and the unbelievable riches that are available in our solar system.
Can I interject one thing here that I don't know if y'all know this or not, but I'm from Volusia County, Florida, and we are one of the people, we are one of the locations that is being considered for the spaceport of that one private company, and I can't remember the name of them now.
Yep, SpaceX is going to be near Brownsville.
There you go.
So you guys are about to have some very, very nice economic rebound.
Well, if we can get it, because here's...
You got it. No, you got it. The FAA just approved the plan. Yep, just came out like 2 weeks ago.
Okay,
that's awesome.
That's awesome because you know who we were in competition with? One of our competitors was China. China is not going to just sit back and not... try to get into this business. They're going to do what they have to get into this business, and we have to get there before them. And we almost lost that thing because of our environmentalist wackos in our county. And so it is just God's grace that we ended up getting that.
Yep.
I want to put my hand up here if I can.
Go, Kelly.
Go for it.
Say, Kelly.
Okay, well, I want to give a compliment to Ken, but first, there is one space exploration that desperately needs to happen. It's this 10 square mile on the East Coast, the space between the ears of the career politicians. And I'll bet if they... I'll bet if they put a probe in there, there would be a big sign on the wall that says, mind everybody's business. And I got to give a huge compliment here for Ken. You know, I was saying, you know, when he noted that Obama, which he doesn't like, you know, I said, oh, my gosh, hold the phone, stop the bus, back up the train. Did Obama say defer it to the private sector? I mean,
And, you know, and it's And the Republicans are the ones who are pushing for the NASA. They call it the Space Launch System, but it's calling it the Senate Launch System because the Senate Republicans are pushing for it. So you got the Republicans pushing for a state solution, and you got Obama pushing for a private solution.
Well, this is somebody.
The irony.
Well, yeah. Well, what
but
I like about well, hold on here. What I like about Ken, you know, he has an area of expertise. You know, a little hobby with studying about space and stuff. And yet, when he found out about Obama, he did some research and found out his conclusion is that the government has set back the private exploration of space. When you have liberty in your heart, you understand the mechanisms of government standing in our way. It just comes to you as it just has. So, you have my compliment.
Thank you.
You know what I'm sorry that I interrupted the thank you, but anyway. I think probably one of Obama's motivations in doing that was because I think he wanted the United States to be behind everyone and in more than one way, not just in space exploration, but I think he also wanted us to be behind in military weaponry. And I think that he knows something we don't know about what was going on there about military weaponry. And what I would like to see is if whatever they had already on the books or already on the paper, the blueprints or whatever, militarily speaking, I think that the private sectors, people who make our weaponry now, ought to be able to bid to see that information, to get a hold of that information and continue on with the production and research and production of weapons that would protect us. At this point, we don't need any more weapons that are going to destroy things. We've got plenty of destroying weapons. We've got to have weapons that protect us because there's too many people acquiring these weapons of mass destruction. And so I think that if NASA doesn't do it, I think that they ought to release the private sector to propagate these kinds of weapons to protect us.
I agree with that completely. And there's one thing that gets in the way is that when the government deals with private contractor, whether it's Lockheed Martin or Boeing or whoever, the government retains the intellectual property rights. So the government can say who gets it, who doesn't get it. So when they build the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, they can say who can buy it overseas and who can't because they own the intellectual property rights. So I agree we should be focusing more on things like missile defense, on coastal defense, things like that. But we'd have to have the government give away a lot of the intellectual property it's held on to. It's good thinking on your part. I'm impressed.
Well,
one more thing.
Unfortunately, yeah, real quick, Cindy, we only have about 20 minutes left in the show. And so, you know, and of course we have closing comments. So, yeah, I'm telling you, this happens all the time. But we'll definitely would like to have you back on the show, Ken. But I do want to mention, because I know myself and Cindy, and I believe, no, Kelly, you're Ron Paul, even from the beginning, but I know Cindy and I were Newt Gingrich supporters, and one of the things that he was proposing was to do mining of helium-3 on the on the moon. And, of course, he was, you know, talked about putting a colony on the moon to mine helium-3. And, of course, he was scoffed at by, you know, the media and, you know, the others in the primary. So what's your thoughts on that?
Well, right now, the next lunar expedition is already being funded. It's happening right now. And the person behind it is Google. They have the Google X Prize. It's $10 million to the first person who lands a rover on the moon and beams back pictures. So that'll be the first step. It'll be happening. There are, what, five different companies trying for the X Prize right now? So sometime in the next several years, you're going to have a private spaceship on the moon. And that's going to start the whole thing. And, of course, Elon Musk and SpaceX, they just announced their new version 2 Dragon capsule, which has the ability to soft land on Earth with the precision of a helicopter. So if they can soft land on Earth, that means that implies they could also soft land on the moon, on Mars, or any other of the planets. So we're on the edge of a brand new space age. I mean, everything's going to be happening in the next year or so. It's exciting times for us space buffs.
I would like to add one real quick point to that. There's another technology that's emerging and being perfected right now, and that is 3D printing technology.
They are
actually designing industrial-sized 3D printers to go to places like the moon and to Mars to build habitats prior to any of us getting there.
Yep, and they're printing the most amazing things. SpaceX, their new capsule I was just talking about, they can land anywhere. The rocket motors on that are being printed. NASA's also doing studies where they can print pizzas, print food using just basic foodstuffs, and they'll print a pizza. They call it additive manufacturing. Yes, 3D printers. Yes. It's amazing what's going on.
Yeah, I see
the
answers for
those. Technology, man.
I want to try a bite of a 3D printed pizza just to see what it's like.
Yeah, and they're printing guns. There's a big buzz.
That
must have been 6 months ago. They're printing guns, and they're printing them in plastic, and they actually work. So this is a groundbreaking thing. This is right out of Star Trek.
Wow.
There you go.
Yep.
This is George Jetson putting the little pill in the thing, and it comes out. This is George Jetson. He puts in this little pill in the machine, and it comes out with a whole meal.
Yep. Exciting times.
But it's about that time. It's about that time to get ready to close things out. It was a great show. I really appreciate you coming on, Ken. And definitely like to have you come back onto the show.
It's a lot of fun.
Less than 15 minutes, and what I like to do is give each person a couple of minutes to make some closing comments before I, you know, close things down. So first, of course, we'll start with you, Cindy, well, the ladies first, and then we'll bring it over to you, James, and then to you, Kelly, and then, Ken, you'll get the last word before I close things out. And then Dan sends his regrets about getting lost on the line. I wish we could have brought him back, but I didn't want to have what happened last week and where I tried to call somebody back. I used to be pretty successful with that. I don't know what's going on where I haven't been able to do that lately, but I'll have to check more into that. But that being said, Cindy, you have the floor for a couple of minutes. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to real quick say I like your viewpoint on labor. You can't outlaw labor unions. That would be ridiculous. That's your amendment, your freedom of assembly. You know, so you have to be able to do that. However, you can keep the unions from forcing people to join them because, you've got a huge problem in the United States right now with people being forced to purchase things they don't want. And that's just one of the many things. And it's a matter of forcing someone to pay to spend money on a particular political view that they don't agree with either. So there's big problems with forced unions or votes that are seen, and you can bully someone into voting the way you want them to vote. That's just ridiculous. But anyway, so I agree with you on your policy on labor. Now, as far as the legalizing of prostitution, you were just talking about that when I had to turn off my computer at one point. So I'm not sure where you went with that. But what I wanted to say was I believe that legalizing prostitution would require the addition of too many new rules, too many new laws to come behind it, because then you're going to have a law that says that a woman, that you have to, if someone goes in and hires a woman and that person has AIDS or some other, and then that person gives it to the woman, how is she protected? Okay, there's going to have to be a law for that. And what if she has an STD and she gives it to any number of Johns? That's going to have to be, now you're going to open up, okay, we have to get into people's medical records. People with AIDS are going to have to be, signed up or whatever, you have to identify them so that they can't.
Right.
You know, it just opens up
the panel. If I could just jump in real quick, Nevada already has legalized prostitution, and they've already solved those problems. But anyway, sorry for interrupting.
Well, that was just one of many that I was thinking of. As I was taking my shower, I was thinking of all these different things that could come up. But anyway, I think that's a bad idea. I think legalizing prostitution would just be a horrible idea. I think it would open up so many more young ladies going into that line of business. You're even talking about opening up businesses on campuses, and I think that would be a bad thing. I just see it. I think if we give them a little more chance to get further into their legalization, I think you're going to see that some problems are going to crop up. But anyway, that's my last word. Thank you, Ken, so much for coming on. Appreciate you.
Thank you, Cindy.
I don't really know who you're running against there, but. Sounds like you should do well against them.
Thank you. Two old party candidates who want to run your life their way.
Who are they?
The incumbent is Tom Corbett, Republican, and he really hasn't done much. He's very vulnerable. The other guy is a relative newcomer, Tom Wolf. He's a Democrat, rich guy who bought the primary by running a lot of ads very early, and nobody else knew who the other people were. But
all right. Well,
we'll see.
Good luck, buddy.
Thank you. I'm having it.
Go ahead, James.
I just wanted to reiterate what I said earlier. I appreciate you kind of changing my opinion a little bit, or at least alleviating some of the distrust that I'd started to get with the Libertarian Party. Just simply because of what happened in Virginia. I mean, I'm a registered Republican. But if you were to affiliate most of my beliefs, it would be with a libertarian mindset or belief structure. But again, it boiled down to that distrust issue. And they've got an interesting history that I think has caused a lot of people to question libertarian candidates. And if we could get some more out there like yourself, I would think that the Libertarian Party might actually see a resurgence. And, we need a viable third party in this country. We really do. I mean, the GOP
Agreed.
And the DNC, they're the same thing. They're the same thing. The DNC and the RNC are the GOP. Well, DNC and RNC, they're the same thing. They're paid by the same people. And it all boils down to corporations and big money. And that's not – we've seen the net result of that, and that's a huge controlling government that's bought and paid for by corporations and special interests, and that's not how you rule a free nation. That's not how you manage a free nation, I guess, would be the more correct word, because they rule it right now. And so, I wish you luck in your pain. Hopefully you'll be able to pull off some sort of miracle and surprise a lot of people. I don't know how you're sitting in the polls, but, I know typically how third-party candidates do. And, it might take some sort of a small miracle to get you in there, but you sound like you're qualified. You sound like
you've
got the right ideas, and you know, you sound like you know, that freedom is your first priority, and that's really what an American candidate and statesman should be, their priority should be. If everybody in Washington, D.C. had liberty in mind first, we wouldn't be in the debacle we're in right now. And, thank you again, you know, for alleviating some of those worries about the Libertarian Party that developed after what happened in Virginia, because that was just extraordinarily frustrating to see how that went down. And then to find out, you know, that they had actually been funded by, you know, Democrats in Texas and, you know, tilted the election away from somebody that actually valued the Constitution. You know, and so, you know, the only hope in Virginia they've got right now with their governor is the fact that they just pulled a fast one with somebody, and now they've got a majority to basically checkmate an Obama zombie that's now their governor. And so they've got that, but it's a shame that when the best thing you have is a stalemate in governor, in government, instead of moving towards something productive, but I would like to, you know, close out things with, again, you know, reminding people that Saturday is Flag Day. However you fly your flags, whether they be upside down as an expression of discontent, with the distress our nation is in, however you do it, do it. You know, let's show the people around us that we are Americans first and foremost, and fly that flag however you fly it proudly.
And James, we have to bring it over to Kelly for just a few moments, and then we'll give it over to Ken. We're quickly running out of time, so go ahead, Kelly, just real quickly.
Well, yeah, I really liked it. Ken came on and really starting to like this guy. I just met him tonight. Of course, he's very detailed, yeah, and thoughtful about his positions, and not just sitting still. Solutions, you know, like on the pro-life and how to limit the amount of abortions. I think that's a really good creative. I like just kind of your knee-jerk reaction to, well, even just the Fugel, you know, or the Fugeli, whatever. I'm sorry, I'm still trying to. It's Latin, by the way. It stands for I fly. And, you know, it says, mind your business. What's stunning about why our government has grown, and I put this together recently, it's called codependency, where a person with codependency has a terrible, terrible low self-esteem, so they have to go ahead and change everybody else for their own, you know, and us libertarians, we have to fight that constantly. Is back off, back off, back off. And so that fundamental problem in the human heart of codependency was really hit stunningly hard with that coin, mind your business. So I'm really glad, you know, several things I threw out, you get right away, and the states and your sovereignty. I just think that's just really cool, and I like how you speak. I can tell you speak with a smile, and I think you mean it.
That's right. I'm a Toastmaster.
Oh, yeah, Toastmaster. There you go.
And I'll have to look more into that. But, Kelly, I hate to say it, but we have to turn it over to Ken.
I'm about ready. I got about 2 seconds here. But, yeah, okay. Ken, if you want, Robert, give him my phone number, and I can see if I can help you with that.
Excellent.
Yeah, definitely. I got the email, so I'll send it through email. So, Ken, the last couple minutes for after close things out is yours.
All right. Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on. This has been entertaining. It's been fun, informative. Just want to say, first of all, my website is kenk.org, kenk.org. And I would urge people, please vote for me, because it's important to vote for really what you want, because people sometimes say that a vote for a third party is a wasted vote. I disagree with that completely, because I would sooner vote for what I want and not get it than vote for what I don't want and, heaven forbid, get it. What I'd like to do is ask people to remember the mantra of the grassroots activist. It's very easy to remember. It's 10 words, 2 letters apiece. if it is to be, it is up to me. So what I'd like to do is ask you to please vote for me, because if people keep voting the way they've been voting, they're going to keep on getting just what they've been getting. And I don't know about you, but I have had enough. Thanks again for having me on. KenK.org is my website. Thanks, Robert. Thanks, yep, James, man. Kelly, and Dan, if you're still listening.
Oh, great.
Definitely. Thank you very much, Ken, for coming on, and we appreciate it. We definitely want to have you on again and get an update for, because, I mean, you're not just a, it's not just a primary campaign you're running. It's going to go to the general election, so we'd just like to have you come back on and give us some updates, see how things are going. So it would be great to have you back
on. Sounds good.
So definitely, folks, share the link with everyone. You can either send it through email, as we said, even on Twitter. And then one of the things, if you're listening to this or listen to it, just put it in your Twitter feed. Just put listening to Bard's Logic and then put in the link, copy and paste in the link, and then put the hashtag PJNet. And also, definitely something you may want to check out, Ken, is the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. And they've done some wonderful things, and I can connect you with the founder, Mark Prasik, where they try to help candidates with their Twitter accounts and get more recognition out there on Twitter. And you'd be amazed at some of the different things you can do. So I can we'll contact after the show, at some point after the show. I mean, not immediately tonight, but and I'll give you more information about the Patriot Journalist Network and how we may be able to work with you on getting out the information about your campaign there in Pennsylvania. So, folks, I want to
thank you
for coming in tonight and listening to the show. It's definitely on archive. Share it with everyone you know, and definitely check out the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. And also, of course, check out the Bard's Logic Political Talk website by going to www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And so I will end tonight, as I do every night, and that is with the song by Aubrey Ashburn. And you can hear more of her music by going to www.aubreyashburn.com. So take care, everyone. Good night, and we will see you next time. Take care.
Bye, everybody.
Take care.
Good night.